We can't mourn forever, okay? I mean, you look at it like this, okay? Ric Flair couldn't have become a 16-time champion without losing 15 times.
And that'll be Charlotte in a month.
It's business time, baby.
You are listening to Solo Monster Sounds Off.
It's such good shit.
Mama Monster.
Conquered my home.
You like fighting a woman?
Your behavior just hasn't been very oozy.
Oh my God, we're only an hour in.
Eric Bischoff is an idiot.
We have two more hours of this.
Maybe the single stupidest idiot that ever got into wrestling.
Who writes this stuff? Bruce?
Come over here and fight me.
I'm the Solo Monster, damn it.
Welcome to the first sound off of the new year. This is episode 789 of the Solo Monster Sounds Off for January 1st, 2023. This morning at the Pro Wrestling Noah show, so spoiler alert, can skip ahead if you don't want to hear about it if you haven't watched it yet. Shinsuke Nakamura returned to Japan for his first match outside of WWE. Since 2016, they had Lee England Jr. He was there to play him to the ring to his WWE theme, which he's done before. We've seen him at the NXT TakeOver shows and Nakamura's main roster debut on SmackDown. He got the full violin entrance. And Nakamura has not felt this big in a very long time. And he came out with a win over the great Muda in Muda's final singles match using the gimmick. I have not seen the full match, but I did see the finish, where Nakamura, after being misted by Muda during the match, he planted a kiss on him, and he basically sucked all the mist from Muda's mouth, and then spit it back into Muda's face, and then nailed him with the Kinshasa and pinned him. This is something that never would have happened under the Vince McMahon regime, but once Triple H took power, I mean, they were able to make it happen. I would love to see more stuff like this in 2023. We see a lot of cooperation between promotions all the time. AEW in New Japan, New Japan in CMLL. It would be nice to see WWE more open to working with other promotions, even though they don't have to. They certainly don't have to. They can be as isolationist as they want to. But I think working with more, you know, promotions like that, it would be fun for the fans. And it probably would make it more appealing for the talent, too, if they want to work there. Also on the show, Kenta returned to Noah to tag with his old partner Naomichi Marufuji for the first time since 2014 to challenge for the GHC tag team titles, which they did not win. So Muda is going to have one last match in the gimmick later this month. He's going to be teaming with his old rival Sting and Darby Allin. But he'll be wrestling his final match for New Japan this Wednesday as Keiji Muto at the Tokyo Dome. And I will have my Wrestle Kingdom predictions later. Not only Wrestle Kingdom, but predictions for all of wrestling in 2023, because today is the annual prediction show that I know you all love so much and look forward to every year. So we're going to be doing predictions a little bit later. I'll look back on what I got right and what I got very wrong in 2022, and then we'll talk about 2023. I've got thoughts on Dragon Lee signing with WWE, Dax Harwood's comments about CM Punk and the Elite from his new podcast, and his plea to all four men. The SmackDown women's title scene is in complete disarray now, with the return of Charlotte Flair and what that means for WrestleMania. I'll talk about that. And some thoughts on the new Ric Flair documentary on Peacock. If you watched it hoping and expecting to hear him address certain topics that he claimed he would, or to learn a lot of new things about him, then this is not the documentary for you. But I'll talk about that later. So a lot to dive into here on the first day of the new year. Let me just mention that one thing that has not changed and will not change in 2023 is that you can still get yourself at least one free audiobook when you use our link, audibletrial.com/solomonster. Right now, you can get the Guy Evans book, Nitro, The Incredible Rise and Inevitable Collapse of Ted Turner's WCW. You can get it free with a 30-day trial using our link. And if you are an Amazon Prime member, you can get two free books when you sign up using that same link. And keep those books even if you end up not committing beyond the 30 days. So again, audibletrial.com/solomonster. Show some love for the show there. If you want to make a PayPal donation, you may do so on thesolemonster.com. You will find the PayPal link at the top of the page. And I have a lot of thank yous to our PayPal producers here. First show of the new year. And I got to give a shout to PB. Thank you. Happy New Year. The Portland pop star as well, Paul Hamilton, who I hope is... I'm jealous of Paul enjoying his Hawaiian vacation. But thank you for the love, brother. Night Stalker, Nayef Al-Safar, Max the Axe Velado. Happy New Year, Max. James Hollywood Herrera, who is turning 32 this Thursday. And yes, to answer your question, Jack and Coke, I think, is a fine choice. For your celebratory drink, you can have one for me, too. John Loose Cannon Lopez, Big B, Brian Becerra, Killshot Keith Hart, the Chicago Slayer Willie Eichard, Velvet Revolver Robert Murray, the Diamond Dallas Dance Machine Harrison Soep, New York Punk Arnold Modesto, John Raging Mad Riffle, Caleb Showtime Lindley, Kingmaker Christos Kalantzis. And we can't leave out Better Than Raw, Robert Michalshek, and Paul Bulletproof Bradshaw. Happy birthday, brother. And New Year, same Lightning Link Lounge. If you like playing games online, you want to try to win some money, some fabulous moolah, Lightning Link Lounge is the place to be. You can play slots, as well as keno and poker games like Texas Hold'em, Blackjack, and Roulette. Thousands of games to choose from. They pay winners daily. For more information, search for Lightning Link Lounge on Facebook, YouTube, Twitter, and TikTok. You have to be 18 years of age or older to play. Ages may vary outside the U.S., and ID is required. Just text 727-910-8809 to get started. It's just that simple. On Friday, we got the worst kind of news that you could get in the form of a tweet from former WCW and TNA announcer Mike Tenay, that Don West passed away at the age of 59. He said, "Just heard from his wife, Terry, that our brother Don West will be spending New Year's in heaven. Terry said that D-Dub finally had to tap out from his match with lymphoma. We bonded as soon as we met, both as broadcast partners and friends. Years of great moments, both on and off camera." And that broke my heart when I read that. This was only a little more than a week after Tenay had posted a photo of Don from their FaceTime call. He got to FaceTime with him thanks to Don's wife, and he called it the best Christmas gift that he could ask for. Jeff Jarrett, who hired West when he came to TNA, tweeted, "Rest in peace, empower Don West. When I received the text from Don's wife, Terry, earlier today on his passing, I had an overwhelming feeling of mixed emotions. So happy and relief for him that he was out of pain and his cancer was gone. But the finality of his death was so dark and it hurt. We FaceTimed just a few days ago, and because of the situation, it's the only conversation I've ever had with him that I got to do all the talking. And I'm sure he hated that. We reminisced, laughed, and I got the final opportunity to tell him that I loved him and that I will see him again one day." It was June of last year when Don was diagnosed with brain lymphoma. And I covered this at the time. 3 months after that, he announced that he was in remission. But then a year ago, he announced that the cancer had returned and the tumor had grown to twice the size that it was previously. And there weren't very many updates from Don anymore after that, which is never a good sign. It's a funny thing how things evolve. You know, when I first heard Don West in TNA, this was back in the early days, right? So we're talking the beginning. We're talking the NWA, TNA days. I knew him as the baseball card guy from the Shop at Home Network. You know, the guy who would be on there late at night hawking sports memorabilia and talking about Michael Jordan's gem mint rookie card. Like, that was the guy that I pictured in my head. I still remember the time he knocked over all the cards on live TV. Never missed a beat. He just got down on the ground. He started swimming in cards. He was still trying to sell them. Because that's what Don was. He was a salesman. He was a pitchman. And a damn good one. The guy could sell ice to an Eskimo. You know, a little fun fact about him. His brother Dale worked for the Shop at Home Network. I don't think he owned it or ran it, but he had a pretty high up executive position at the network. And when Don applied for a job there to host his own show, his brother didn't think it was a good idea because of his voice. He said basically his voice was like nails on a chalkboard. He didn't think anybody would want to listen to him for hours on end. And eventually he got the job, and in the time that Don worked there, almost a decade, I think it was about 8 or 9 years that he spent at the network, sales rose from $3 million to $150 million in that 8 or 9 year span. And Don had a lot to do with that. You know, I would not have called him a great wrestling announcer when he first started. I can see what his brother was talking about with that voice and all the over-the-top screaming. But over time, you know, a funny thing happened. He got better. He improved. And he's one of those people I gained an appreciation for that I did not have early on. You know, now I go back and I watch some of those old TNA clips when they pop up on my timeline. The Elix Skipper clip, you know, from the top of the cage. Or Kurt Angle somersaulting off the stage onto Abyss at one of their pay-per-views. Might have been Turning Point. Turning Point or Bound for Glory, I forgot which one. But, you know, I watch those clips and I love and I miss that level of enthusiasm. You know, Jim Ross always had this over-the-top enthusiasm. Mauro Ranallo in NXT had that over-the-top enthusiasm. And Don West, he wasn't a play-by-play guy like those two were, but he had that same level of energy. And that's just something we don't get enough of anymore on commentary. We kind of get it with Pat McAfee. You know, Pat's kind of a throwback, I guess, in that way. But we just don't get enough of that. So it's funny to look back on how I felt then and now. You know, now I would say that if anything, Don is underrated as a color commentator and doesn't get enough love. To the people who grew up being big fans of TNA, Mike Tenay and Don West were to them what Jim Ross and Jerry Lawler were for people who watched, you know, WWE during the Attitude Era. You know, Mike and Don, they made a great combo. And again, I don't think I appreciated them at the time the way that I do now. But his passion was just, it was infectious. I mean, look, I got to meet him in 2011 when TNA held their first baseball show at MCU Park in Coney Island. And back then, I think it was Keyspan Park. In Coney Island, where the Brooklyn Cyclones play. I talked about the whole thing on the Sound Off at the time, episode 166. And I got to see Don in action up close for the first time. You know, waiting in line outside the stadium. He was pitching his brown bag special that had a bunch of random items in it. And I was worried for him. I was worried that this guy was going to drop dead of a heart attack. His face was, it was just turning beet red as he was making the sales pitch. It was exhausting to listen to. You know, he would wear you out, but it worked. He sold every one of those brown bags. He had a crowd around him. And you want to know how much of an asset that Don West was to TNA when it came to their merch. Bruce Pritchard, on his podcast once, said that Don West may have single-handedly been responsible for TNA house shows turning a profit because of their merchandise sales. He claims they would make more from their merch than they would at the gate. Think about that. They made more money off all the shit that they would sell once you got into the building than they did on the tickets to the actual shows themselves. And he said the WWE would draw about $15 per head at the time in merch. TNA was drawing $24 or more at a lot of their events. That is nuts. The first TNA show I ever went to was their first New York City show. It was at Webster Hall. When the show was over, they did a gimmick where for $20 you could get in the ring and take your picture with Kurt Angle. He was the world champion at the time. He had just finished wrestling Christian Cage in the main event. So I said, you know, I was with my brother at the show that night. A friend of mine, I think, was going to come and couldn't make it. I was like, as we're leaving, I'm looking because there was kind of a log jam. And we had tickets in the first few rows. So I'm already at ringside. I'm up against the ring. I'm leaning on the apron. Kurt's in the ring. People are coming into the ring. And I'm just like, you know what? Like, what the hell? So I paid the $20. I got in the ring. I got to pose with the TNA world title. I got a Polaroid with Kurt Angle. The thing that stuck with me was the spaced out, glassy eyed look on his face. But this was, when was this? This was 2008. So this was probably peak Perk Angle during this period. So that's about what I would expect. And yet he still went out there and had a great match. But they did the $20 Polaroid in the ring gimmick after every single show. And I'm pretty sure that was a Don West idea. And they probably made a small fortune off that. Yeah, it's like Scott D'Amore said, the only man who could sell 5,000 D'Lo Brown bobbleheads after D'Lo Brown left the company. And I got a picture with Don at the baseball stadium show. I got to talk to him for, you know, a couple of minutes, and he was the nicest guy. And you know how you meet somebody the first time and you could just tell right off like what kind of person they are? That was Don West. And everybody who knew him better than I did and who worked with him in TNA and everybody who's commented this week and posted tweets has said the exact same thing, that he was just the nicest guy, always positive, always full of energy. Even when they did that angle in TNA where he cut a heel promo on Mike Tenay, he turned heel on Mike Tenay. He was really good. And then they made him a manager for the Amazing Red for a hot minute, right? House of Glory's own Amazing Red. It didn't last very long, but I know Red has been very complimentary of Don in the past and has said that he was always putting him over. He said Don is the reason why he got his own action figure. So you won't find a bad word said about the man. My condolences to his family and his friends. And one last thing that I thought was a little eerie about the timing of this. Pele passed this week on Thursday, one day before Don did, also from cancer. Considered by FIFA and others to be the greatest footballer of all time, right? The only man to ever win three World Cups. Don West is the man who named AJ Styles' overhead kick the Pele kick. Don is the one who gave the move that name in TNA. And now Pele and Don West both die 24 hours apart. I just thought that was a little eerie. Speaking of AJ Styles, he didn't get off unscathed this week either. But at least he's still breathing, so he's got that going for him. He was working a trios match with his fellow OC members against the Judgment Day in Hershey, Pennsylvania on Thursday when he went out over the top rope. He landed awkwardly on his foot. He grabbed his left ankle, had to be helped to the back because he couldn't put any weight on the leg. And yesterday, Styles tweeted the bad news that he has suffered a broken ankle. He said, "Just want you guys to know that I'm okay. Broken ankle is what I'm dealing with. No surgery. This just takes some time to recover. This will be the longest I've ever been out of the ring. Thanks for the prayers and get well wishes." So he's lucky he doesn't need surgery or else he'd be out a lot longer. But even without surgery, WrestleMania doesn't look very likely. You know, it sounds like 3 to 4 months for recovery is about what he's looking at if everything goes according to plan. So it would be tough. Not impossible, but tough. Maybe if there's a battle royal or something, he could be like a surprise entrant. But I don't see there being an AJ Styles program heading into WrestleMania. There's never a good time to break your ankle, but to do it this time of year is just the worst. WWE made headlines this week by signing AAA star Dragon Lee, with ESPN reporting that he will be starting with the company this month and working for the NXT brand. I mean, how else will he ever learn where the hard camera is? The announcement was made by Dragon Lee in the ring on Wednesday, immediately after he and his brother Dralístico won the AAA tag team titles from FTR at their Noche de Campeones event in Acapulco. Just as soon as they won them, they turned around and they vacated them. And if that sounds like it was a last-minute thing, it was not. This was something that was known weeks ago when Dragon Lee came to an agreement with WWE. And keeping it quiet until Wednesday's show was part of that agreement. Dave Meltzer says that Tony Khan was aware of what was happening with Dragon Lee and that Dragon Lee and Dralístico were going to be beating FTR to win the titles. And he did not ask that, you know, Dralístico be the one to score the winning pinfall on his guy instead of Dragon Lee getting the pin, which he did. On Twitter, Triple H called Lee an unbelievable athlete who has collected accolades and held championships across the globe. And he is just getting started. The next chapter of Dragon Lee's career begins with NXT. And WWE's head of talent, strategy, and operations, James Kimble, not to be confused with Detective John Kimble from Kindergarten Cop, said, "It's not a tumor." No, he said, "Dragon Lee is a tremendous talent that will immediately add value to the NXT roster. This signing is reflective of WWE's renewed emphasis on globalizing our talent pipeline with Latin America positioned as a focal market." Meltzer says the contract is a 3-year deal for what he calls NXT money and not main roster money, but that it is higher than the standard NXT deal and it has pay increases built into it each year. It would make him the highest paid NXT talent now that Mandy Rose has gone from the company. He said the impetus for Lee signing was that it was time to make a move. Given the current situation in Mexico when it comes to making money, he claims that Lee wanted to work for New Japan, and New Japan loved him, but that was not an option because of New Japan's partnership with CMLL, which is AAA's mortal enemy. And Dragon Lee used to work for CMLL with his brother Roosh. It's a big family. Lots of brothers here. So he used to work for CMLL with Roosh, who of course is currently signed to AEW. But if you remember, I covered this on the Sound Off at the time, episode 619. Roosh and Dragon Lee were both fired by CMLL in 2019, the day after Ring of Honor's Death Before Dishonor pay-per-view. They were not happy with Lee after he worked the Battle of Los Angeles for PWG, when they told him not to because there was AAA talent working the tournament as well. Oh my god! Oh no! There's AAA talent on the show. Well, they didn't want him working the show. He worked it anyway. I mean, this AAA CMLL stuff, it's like two warring mob families. I mean, it is just, it's ridiculous. WWE and AEW were both interested in signing him, but WWE was even more interested in signing him after his Dynamite appearance in August, and when they learned that he was working without a contract when he appeared on Dynamite that night, all of a sudden WWE perked up and they had a ton of interest in signing Dragon Lee. So that was the night Kenny Omega returned for the Trios tournament, and he tagged with the Young Bucks against Andrade and Roosh and Dragon Lee. And if you remember when the match was over, Andrade and Roosh, they turned on Dragon Lee. And Andrade gave him a hammerlock DDT, and Dragon Lee's mask went flying off his head. It was a very confusing finish, especially because it never led to anything. It never got followed up on, but I guess it was never followed up on because he didn't sign a contract. Triple H was not even on the job for a full month by that point. He was in the middle of a signing spree. He was bringing back old names, right, to make their return to TV. I can believe that he wanted to make a splash by signing someone like Dragon Lee. You know, he was trying to create a buzz for the product and an excitement that was lacking under Vince McMahon. We heard similar stories about a month later about Bandido after he had that great match with Chris Jericho on Dynamite that they took notice and they wanted to sign him, and they did make him an offer, but ultimately Bandido chose to sign with AEW. And he has wrestled a grand total of two matches for the company since then. Both in the world title eliminator. One was a win over his brother, and then he lost to Ethan Page. We have not seen him since. And I am hoping that that is just a matter of him wrapping up commitments elsewhere, because I know he's been wrestling in Mexico. It's not like he's been sitting at home waiting by the phone for Tony Khan to call. He's been working. Someone the other night tried to explain to me, oh, well, you know, maybe he's part of the Ring of Honor roster, and Tony is just holding him out until they launch their weekly show. Then that must be news to the AEW web team, because if you go to their website, Bandido is very clearly listed on the AEW roster. He is not listed on the Ring of Honor roster because they have their own roster page on their own website, and he is nowhere to be found. He is an AEW guy. Doesn't mean that he can't work for the Ring of Honor brand once the weekly show launches. I mean, look, he's, you know, a former Ring of Honor world champion. But right now he's an AEW guy, so that is not an excuse. It's very likely that had Dragon Lee signed with AEW, it would have been the same situation. A lot of fanfare initially, and then lots of frustration about where the hell is Dragon Lee? He'd be the new Miro. AEW also made an offer to him. Meltzer says that he went to friends for advice on which deal he should take. And at least one of those friends advised against AEW for fear that he would get lost in the shuffle. Just so happens that he is very good friends with Andrade. I would bet anything that Andrade is the one who gave him that advice. Which, if that's the case, if that's true, I find that very amusing because 3 years ago, it was Andrade who advised Roosh and Dragon Lee against going to WWE. And now I could easily see him advising Dragon Lee to do the opposite. Lee was also interviewed by ESPN, and he said that Finn Balor was responsible for helping him get into the company. A few months ago, Balor asked him, "Would you like to join WWE?" And he said, "Yeah, sure, why not?" And the Cubs fan who covers the Lucha Libre promotions and is pretty well plugged into that scene said that Lee had a couple of WWE tryouts in recent months, and it was after that second tryout that he was offered a deal. You know, he's worked for Ring of Honor, he's worked for AAA, CMLL, New Japan, AEW, pretty much everywhere but WWE. He is well-traveled for a 27-year-old. Yeah, he even worked a match for us at House of Glory 6 months ago. It was he and Drellistico against Midas Black and Jay Lyon, who are now our HOG Tag Team Champions. So I am well aware of how talented this man is. I would go so far as to say that he is the biggest luchador they could sign right now, not named Vikingo, who is the most talked about luchador in all of wrestling right now. WWE is clearly excited about the signing. They gave the news to ESPN to break, and they're already said to be producing introductory videos for him. It's encouraging to see. It's encouraging to see that. It's encouraging to hear that. You know, the news broke while I was streaming after Dynamite, so I didn't get to read the news until later. You guys are the ones who broke the news to me live. But people were talking about this like it was this major deal. And I would caution people to curb their enthusiasm just a little bit. I think some people have unrealistic expectations for Dragon Lee. As far as exactly, oh, he's going to be one of their big top stars. Like, no, no. But this is a Triple H booked WWE now. Not Vince McMahon. Times are changing. And maybe a really dynamic lucha star like Dragon Lee could be treated as big of a deal on TV as they're treating his signing so far. It's possible. But again, I would caution people to pump the brakes a little bit. We have seen these big international acquisitions come in before with all of this fanfare and then fizzle out, right? We have seen this story play out before. We saw it years ago with Mystico, who became Sin Cara, the original. He was the first name I heard about being likened to the next Rey Mysterio. This guy was incredible. WWE held a press conference for him. It was hailed as such a big signing at the time. That didn't work out too well. And one of the things that he complained about was that WWE would not allow him to work the style of match that he was doing in Mexico, which is what got him over in the first place. Right? We've seen that with people before, where they work a certain style elsewhere, and it's not just luchadors, it could be talent from anywhere, UK talent. They work a certain style, a certain fast-paced style somewhere else. They come to WWE, and they force them to slow down. Right? And I can understand why they would want them to do that for longevity, and it's just not the way they do things, right? You gotta slow down, right? Slow things down. But there are just some people where, you know, you're gonna watch them and think, man, this is not the same guy that I saw working in these other promotions. I'm seeing it today. Shinsuke Nakamura had the match with Great Muta this morning. And I'm already seeing comments on my timeline from people. Oh, we gotta get this Nakamura. Oh, what a great match. Why can't we get this Nakamura in WWE, right? We don't get to see this guy in WWE. So again, that could be something that ends up being an issue as well. But we saw it with Mystico. We saw it with Kenta. They had a contract signing for him in the ring in Japan. None other than Hulk Hogan. They flew Hulk Hogan over to Japan to be in the ring for the contract signing for Kenta. One of the main reasons they signed him was because WWE Network was launching in Japan the following year, and they wanted this big Japanese star for it. Now, to be fair, Kenta was plagued by injuries for a lot of his run there. That's not WWE's fault. And I think he would have won the NXT championship from Kevin Owens and not Finn Balor. Finn Balor ended up winning it from Kevin Owens had he not gotten hurt. But we'll never know how his run would have gone. And he doesn't like talking about it. He'd rather forget that it ever happened. We saw it with Kushida, who was doomed. Once they gutted NXT and they converted it to 2.0, Kushida was doomed. We saw it with Grand Metalik. And do you know what led to Metalik being in the Cruiserweight Classic, which is what got him noticed in WWE? His friendship with Finn Balor. So I hope that things work out better for Dragon Lee than they did for the last person that Balor recommended to WWE. Because Metalik, look, he spent years there. I'm not saying that, I'm sure he made good money, and that's probably one of the reasons why he went there. But again, people had certain expectations for this guy. And I don't think you're going to find too many people who would look back on Grand Metalik's run and the Lucha House Party and all that and say, oh, they really maximized, you know, this guy's potential. I don't think too many people are going to look at that and be saying that. Kalisto. Kalisto is another one, although he was born in Chicago. Working under a mask, ended up winning two United States titles and a cruiserweight title. He spent almost a decade working for WWE and still owns one of the craziest spots that I have ever seen with that Salida del Sol off a ladder to Jey Uso at that TLC pay-per-view. But he was someone, you know, under a mask who went to WWE and was able to find success. So you never really know for sure how these things are going to work out. This man, Dragon Lee, is taking a chance on himself. He's going to be moving to Orlando with his family. I'm sure he'll be given a new name. They could very well take his mask away from him like they did with Andrade because they felt, oh, he's too handsome to be wearing a mask. But I think they have been actively looking for a new masked luchador, which if that's the case, there you go. You got him, right? You won't find very many better than this guy. And Dragon Lee told ESPN that signing with WWE was always the dream. He thinks that he can become the next Rey Mysterio. He just needs the opportunity. WWE's been trying to find the next Rey Mysterio for fucking 20 years now. And they have failed to do so. One of the reasons that they have failed, and something that worked in Rey's favor, is the fact that he speaks fluent English. And in WWE, it's very difficult to get over or to get opportunities to get over traditionally if you do not speak at least decent English. Your promo ability is even more important than what you can do in the ring there. It's always been that way in WWE. Whether people want to admit that or not, it's going to be a problem for him when it comes to their scripted promos. But he admits in the ESPN story that one of his goals is to work on becoming a more well-rounded performer. He said he's been working on his English. He said that it's his challenge to learn more about promos and that it's something that is new for him and he would like to learn something new. So he gets it. He's saying all the right things. It sounds like he gets it. He understands that if you go to WWE, this is what you are going to have to do. So it makes sense for him to start with NXT because this is all new territory for him, right down to how they produce television, time cues, where the cameras are. I mean, these are all things that we take for granted when we watch these shows. Everything feels so seamless, but there's going to be a steep learning curve for him. One good thing is that NXT has had a better track record than the main roster has when it comes to lucha talent. You know, two recent examples are Andrade and Santos Escobar. They had great runs on the NXT brand. Andrade peaked in that company with the matches that he had with Johnny Gargano and Aleister Black. He was never the same on the main roster. With Escobar and Legado del Fantasma, the jury is still out. He hasn't been up on SmackDown for very long. For WWE, you know, why this is a big deal? Really, there's two reasons. Number one, it represents a shift with Triple H running creative. You are going to see more names like Dragon Lee, who might have otherwise signed with AEW. Seriously consider a run with WWE and talk to people, as he did with Balor, about coming in. Should they or shouldn't they? What should I do? What do you advise? And they're going to be told, you need to be here. Things are different now. You'll find more success here now than you would have before. You know, WrestleVotes tweeted this week that WWE is hopeful of the signing of Dragon Lee being just the start of standout talent agreeing to terms with the company. And they're hearing that Triple H and his crew have expectations to land other high-quality names early in 2023. This is where the real value of this signing is for this company. Now, the other reason is, if their ultimate goal is to make inroads in the Mexican market, you know that they're looking to expand the NXT brand into other countries and open additional performance centers. They've talked about, look, we have NXT Europe launching this year at some point. Shawn Michaels has flat out said that there has been talk of NXT Japan and NXT Mexico, with those announcements coming as soon as later this year. This year. So signing someone like Dragon Lee for the NXT brand is all of a sudden very appealing to them. And it's the sort of thing that Triple H was not shy about during the Black and Gold era when he signed lots of international talents for that brand. Whether it be Asuka or Neville or Kenta or Finn Balor or Shinsuke Nakamura. They all started in NXT. So WWE has got themselves a quality talent in Dragon Lee, but it's what his signing represents in the larger sense that is going to make for a very interesting 2023 in the world of wrestling. For his sake, I hope he doesn't uproot his entire family just to spend the next 3 years toiling away at the Performance Center. making NXT money until nobody really cares anymore. But he's only 27 years old. If it doesn't work out, at least he can say that he tried, and he would still be young enough that he can go tear it up somewhere else. Spot calling Cena was back on SmackDown on Friday night, our old friend, tagging with Kevin Owens to beat Roman Reigns and Sami Zayn. It was the return of John Cena. You can't see him, but you can damn sure hear him. They basically had a house show match on TV. It felt very rushed. Cena did not do much at all. But what he did, the fans went crazy for. The spot calling during the match, just while he was standing on the apron, he wasn't even in the actual ring, turned the match into a comedy. I mean, it was ridiculous. There was no hint at any WrestleMania direction for him because according to WrestlingNews.co, the latest update that we have is that the planned match for WrestleMania is going to be John Cena one-on-one with Logan Paul. It's the match that Logan Paul said weeks ago. He texted Triple H, "Are you ready to break the internet again?" This is the match that he wanted. Logan Paul right now is out with an injury. He was not involved in this match on Friday, so there was no tease of anything, but that looks to be the plan. And again, that's I said this on Friday. That's fine. That's fine. I said this weeks ago when this was first floated, when I was talking about potential opponents for Steve Austin and John Cena. I said I would be okay with that. It would not be my first choice, but I would be okay with that. Logan had a great match with Roman Reigns at Crown Jewel. I don't know that a match with John Cena would be nearly as good, because in the ring, this is just not the same John Cena. It was noticeable in his SummerSlam match with Roman Reigns last year as well. But I noticed it, even though he didn't do much, I noticed it even on Friday. I don't want to say he's washed up necessarily, but he is older. He is not doing this full-time or even part-time like he used to. And in the ring, from what I've seen the last few times, this is not the same John Cena. But I think they could still have an entertaining match. I think Seth Rollins would give Logan the better match. But the bigger match of the two would be John Cena. And Kevin Owens pinned Sami Zayn to win the match, which is the perfect setup now for Owens to challenge Roman Reigns for the championship at the Royal Rumble. WrestlingNews.co also reported that the match for WrestleMania, and this was before what happened on SmackDown, was going to be Ronda Rousey defending her SmackDown Women's Championship against Rhea Ripley. Which sounded very odd, given that both women are heels, and Rhea is part of a faction that belongs to Monday Night Raw. I mean, she could win the Royal Rumble, and then challenge for the SmackDown title, but it's still a weird match, right? It sounded very, very strange to me. But it's all moot now anyway, because on Friday night, after beating Raquel Rodriguez, Ronda Rousey was challenged by the returning Charlotte Flair to a championship match, accepted, and was quickly pinned. So Ronda Rousey is no longer the SmackDown Women's Champion. Charlotte cashed in her Charlotte in the Bank contract and is now a 14-time Women's Champion, not counting her two NXT titles. If you do count those, she's already tied her father's phony record. But WWE is not counting those two, so she needs two more to tie them. She'll have her father's record beat within 18 months. That's the timeline I put on it. 18 months max, she'll have it beat. We had Vince McMahon booking from the Shadow Realm on Friday night. I mean, if you're Sasha Banks, why would you even want to come back to this? Run fast and far away as you possibly can. And then people wonder why so many fans have a hate boner for this woman. I give you Exhibit A. This is why so many people resent Charlotte Flair. It's the booking. This woman was gone for 7 months. It took less than 60 seconds for her to get gold back around her waist. With the same lame roll-up finish that Liv Morgan used to beat Ronda at Money in the Bank. I don't think Ronda is capable of losing any other way. It's almost like they're afraid. They're terrified to have her lose a match in any other way. The fans in Tampa loved it. Of course they did. They actually missed seeing her because she's been gone for so long, and they got to see a surprise title change. It's no different than the way people go nuts whenever there's a Money in the Bank cash-in, right? They just want to see a title change hands when they least expect it. So, of course, they were going to lose their minds. Even better, it means that Ronda Rousey is no longer the SmackDown Women's Champion. It is the classic example of be careful what you wish for as the monkey's paw curls, right? The good news The good news is Ronda is no longer the champion. The bad news is that Charlotte is the champion. We are right back to where we were at Backlash. They're just trading the belt back and forth like they're rocking Austin. Ronda Rousey's run as the champion was horrendous. She will go down as one of the most boring champions of all time. And I really thought a heel turn was the way to go with her, and pairing her up with Shayna Baszler, they finally did those two things, but it did nothing to help the situation. Nothing. She's in the ring cutting a promo on Charlotte, asking, oh, you're out here to challenge me to a title match at SummerSlam. Ronda's out there thinking she's back in UFC and she's got 6 months for a fucking training camp. Then she corrected herself and she said Royal Rumble. And we may yet get that match again at the Royal Rumble. Ronda certainly has an argument for a rematch. A proper rematch where she isn't ambushed like she was on Friday. But who asked for this? Who asked for this? Who asked for another round of Charlotte Flair and Ronda Rousey? Charlotte as a babyface just doesn't work in the long run. The woman is a natural heel. I will be shocked if she even makes it to WrestleMania as a babyface. If that is what they want her to be. She was a babyface on Friday because she beat Ronda. That doesn't necessarily mean she's going to be a babyface this Friday. So we have to wait and see. The match I proposed in the mailbag segment a few weeks ago was Charlotte coming back and working a program with Raquel at WrestleMania. She would be a new opponent for her to work with. I know they're pretty high on Raquel. They could still get there even though Raquel lost. She actually had a real good match with Ronda. They could still do Charlotte and Raquel at WrestleMania if they wanted to. They're not going to, but if they want to, they certainly could do it. But what's next for Ronda Rousey? All right, we have multiple outlets now, multiple websites reporting that the plans for a match with Becky Lynch and Ronda Rousey, which seemed to be the obvious match for them to do, those plans are out the window for WrestleMania. That's no longer in the plans. Steve Mulehausen, who works for DAZN's wrestling and MMA sections, says, according to his sources, people close to Becky Lynch feel that the match has lost its luster and should have been one-on-one at WrestleMania 35 when Ronda was at her apex. Yeah, no shit. I said the same thing back then. So did how many other thousands of people. The money match was trash-talking Becky Lynch against Ronda Rousey. That was the match that people wanted to see. But here's what happened. The first ever women's main event at WrestleMania was going to be Charlotte Flair against Ronda Rousey. I am telling you that shit was already planned out at least 6 months before. You cannot convince me otherwise. That was the match that was absolutely planned for WrestleMania 35. But then Becky Lynch got hot at a time when they weren't expecting it and the fans screwed with their plans, as they have done before for WrestleMania, right? Where the fans fuck with their plans. Not the first time that's happened. But they were not going to make history and not have Charlotte Flair involved. So they shoehorned her into the match. We got one great segment on TV with all three women. The brawl in the parking lot with the cops. That was great. But it should have been Becky against Ronda one-on-one, and Becky Lynch feels the exact same way. Now it's going to be 4 years later, and this is not the same Ronda Rousey that we saw on WWE television heading into WrestleMania 35. She no longer feels like an attraction. She has been exposed. They're not wrong in feeling that the match has lost its luster. It's going to be 4 years. Of course it has. I think Ronda and Shayna could go after the women's tag team titles. Ronda has said that that is something that she would like to do. But there's also another possibility here, which is that Ronda Rousey is done. She came back at last year's Royal Rumble. We're coming up on 1 year since her return. Maybe she only came back for a one-year run. I find it hard to believe they would not have worked in a WrestleMania appearance. But maybe she's rumble to rumble, and she does one last match with Charlotte to put her over on her way out. I mean, as if Charlotte needs it. But that is a possibility, too. But I don't know what they're going to do with Becky Lynch. If they're not doing Becky Lynch and Ronda Rousey, I don't know what they do with Becky Lynch. One good thing about Charlotte winning the SmackDown Women's Championship is that it paved the way for Rhea Ripley to challenge Bianca Belair for the Raw Women's title. That should be the WrestleMania match. But then I don't know where that leaves Becky Lynch unless they make it a triple threat. Or as she would say, a triple threat. We had a Bray Wyatt segment with Uncle Howdy, or is it Uncle Harper? We're not sure. It looked a little bit different. On SmackDown on Friday night, where Uncle Whoever laid out Bray with a Sister Abigail in an in-ring segment that Bray was having with LA Knight. And I don't know, you know, I watched whoever was under the mask and in that outfit. It reminded me of Cameron Grimes. Cameron Grimes is due for a main roster call-up. It could very well be him. It could be Bo Dallas. It could be Vincent of the Righteous. Vincenzo. Vincenzo in Dutch from Ring of Honor. Because if you look at the photographs of the person who was in the mask on Friday night, there was an opening for a big bushy gray beard to stick out through the mask. So there's a lot of people who think maybe it's Vincent from Vincent and Dutch, who also signed with WWE. Who knows? The answer is nobody knows. Bray Wyatt knows. Bray Wyatt and the people who are writing his shit on the show, Rob Fee, right? The head of creative over there on SmackDown, one of their head writers, they know. Nobody knows for sure exactly who is going to be revealed as Uncle Howdy or Uncle Harper or exactly what is going on here. What we do know is that Bray Wyatt and LA Knight will have a match at the Royal Rumble. It has been official, made official, that it will be a pitch black match at the Royal Rumble. And it got its name from Mountain Dew, which is sponsoring this year's Royal Rumble. They have a new flavor out called Pitch Black. It's not really a new flavor. Apparently, they first introduced it for Halloween in 2004. I wouldn't call that new, but it's had several limited runs since. It's like the McRib of Mountain Dew. And it's had some limited runs since then, and apparently it's getting another limited run this month. So we don't yet know what a pitch black match entails. If they're going to dim the lights, if it's going to be a blindfold match. I said on the stream on Friday, maybe the objective is to drink Mountain Dew until you go pitch black and pass out. I don't know. But now at least we know when Bray Wyatt is going. I say get back in the ring, but again, we don't know the rules of the match. Who knows? Maybe it's not going to be in ring. Maybe it'll be cinematic. We don't know until they make an announcement. We have an update on Tyson Fury and WWE. This comes from The Sun, and I know it's The Sun, so you can probably find more accurate information inside the actual Sun than you would on The Sun website, but there may be smoke to this fire. They claim that Tyson Fury's immigration problems and inability to enter the United States is costing him millions of dollars in paydays from WWE. The story says that WWE executives had been plotting for Fury to make an appearance at the Royal Rumble at the Alamo Dome in San Antonio, Texas in January, and they had an eye on a match at WrestleMania 39 in Los Angeles in April. Fury won his WWE debut in October of 2019, beating Braun Strowman, and made a surprise cameo at Clash at the Castle. Now those hopes are looking slim and complicated, the U.S. Sun has learned. The former WBC heavyweight, well, the U.S. Sun, is that, well, it's got to be all connected, right? U.S. Sun, U.K. Sun. I imagine it's all owned by the same parent company. The former WBC heavyweight champion is banned from entering the U.S. after links to alleged Irish mob boss Daniel Kinahan emerged, someone Fury has praised as a friend and an advisor in the past. The boxer's team is responsible for ensuring he fulfills the credentials needed to work in the U.S., while WWE's lawyers have expertise in dealing with foreign athletes. Recently, Fury's younger brother, Tommy, confirmed that they are still being refused permission to enter the country. Tommy, who was due to fight Jake Paul in New York City, said it was apparently due to connections to Kinahan. And it says here that Fury was being wooed by show bosses to appear in 2023 as CEO and chairwoman Stephanie McMahon and creative director Paul Triple H Levesque are huge fans of the Gypsy King. An insider told the U.S. Sun, Tyson is well-loved in WWE, and him popping up in any match and a run to WrestleMania would generate huge headlines and fan interest. However, his immigration status is proving tricky to deal with, and people may not believe this, but turning up for a match or being part of the shows, not even fighting, earns him several million dollars. It says the legal team are on the sidelines offering support in this matter, but ultimately getting approval is on Tyson's head and how U.S. immigration assesses his case. The source added, it's not all bad news for Tyson because there are other options for WWE through their premium live events outside the U.S., and it's very likely that they will go to Saudi Arabia. twice a year for those bigger nights, and of course there are often European battles. But having a potential invite to feature in something special at WrestleMania is a huge deal, and currently those shows are only in the USA. Now, it says here that in April, the U.S. Department of Treasury levied sanctions on Kinahan and several of his associates and barred them from entering the U.S. And the Treasury is offering a $5 million award, or is it reward? This says award, for anybody who offers information leading to the arrest or conviction of Kinahan. Several outlets have reported that the number of Kinahan-related people barred from the U.S. is in the neighborhood of 600. Including hundreds involved in boxing. Now, Meltzer in The Observer said, according to one major WWE source, he could not say the story wasn't true, but noted that it was not something being talked about. The classic non-answer answer. It's not necessarily false, but we're also not talking about this at all. But he says that it was noted to him that Fury was not willing to put people over or even look vulnerable. I've never understood the appeal of Tyson Fury in WWE. I know his appeal in the boxing world. I get that, right? He's one of the greatest to ever do it. And he's good at karaoke, right? He can sing songs. Good for him. I've never understood the appeal of Tyson Fury in WWE. I thought the match that he had with Braun Strowman in Saudi Arabia was a fucking bore fest. I thought it sucked. We've seen other celebrities since then come in and kill it, right? His being in the Royal Rumble. Now, it didn't say he would be in the Rumble match, right? It said an appearance at the Rumble. But let's say he was in the Rumble, right? Or he had a match at WrestleMania. I have about as much interest in seeing a ham sandwich in there as I do Tyson Fury. I don't care. I can't be the only one. I don't care. And if he's not willing to even look vulnerable in a match or in an appearance, then there is no fucking point in doing business with him. How would a Royal Rumble cameo even work if he is not willing to lose? Let's say he was in the Royal Rumble match. The man is 6'9". Does he think that if he goes under the bottom rope, nobody will notice? Save him for the Saudi Arabia shows. We've got Pat McAfee. We've got Logan Paul, who's got his own issues going on right now. We've got Bad Bunny. I think they've reached their celebrity quota. They don't need to spend millions of dollars on Tyson Fury, especially if he's not willing to play ball and make other people look good. But yeah, they got their hands full. You know, this Logan Paul thing with the crypto stuff that's going on. Now this, Irish mob connections. Boy, the people this company is doing business with, it's becoming quite a very troublesome list here. But let's switch over. Let's switch over to AEW here for a few minutes. Because Dax Harwood has a new podcast, and it is called FTR with Dax Harwood, FTR being family, tequila, and wrestling. And his first episode was all about his good friend, CM Punk. That's one way to get people to tune into your first show. Punk and FTR, they became very good friends in AEW, and they worked that one trios match on TV together when they came to LA for the first time. That was the night that Punk broke his foot on that stage dive coming to the ring. And boy, you know, you talk about what if scenarios, what if things had gone differently? What if Punk didn't do that dive into the crowd that night and broke his foot? How different things would have looked for AEW in 2022. So we are getting here with this show, we are getting the perspective of someone who is clearly and openly a Punk guy. He is from the Punk camp when he talks about this. And look, the Elite certainly have their friends as well, right? They got some friends in high places. FTR, though, obviously close to CM, or at least Dax is. I don't know how close Cash Wheeler is with CM Punk. Cash Wheeler doesn't do as much talking as Dax Harwood does, but Dax obviously is very close to CM Punk. Among the topics that he discussed was how his friendship with Punk came to be. He said, we had a match with Proud and Powerful, Santana and Ortiz, and he loved the match. He told me that he had been wanting to see us work live because he had seen us before. We just kind of started talking about that, and obviously the love of Bret Hart came into play. Well, I can understand that. We're both enamored with him. We both think he's the greatest. He knew coming in that he was going to eventually work with Max in an angle, so he called all the guys in the Pinnacle into his locker room. Again, I said this before, his locker room door always open. You could walk in and walk out without knocking and say hello. He was incredible at that. He brought us into his locker room, he sat everybody down, and he said, "We're all going to be working together soon. I can't wait to work with you guys. I'm a fan of every single one of you, and I hope we can make a ton of money together and hope that we can make a ton of money for this company. Just to show my appreciation, I have these for you." He knew that most of us were coffee connoisseurs, or we loved coffee, and he had these gift cards for Starbucks with like $500 on each card, and he gave it to myself, to Cash, to Sean, that being Sean Spears, Wardlow, and Max. He said, "I know this isn't much, but this is to show my appreciation for you guys allowing me to work with you." And he said that's kind of how things got rolling as far as their relationship is concerned. He claimed that Punk did not want to win the AEW World title. He did so because he recognized that it would help the company, but it was not his idea. He said, "To be honest, he told me when they were going to put the belt on him, he didn't want the belt. He said, I just want to have fun. But he understood that Tony putting the belt on him would put AEW in a new and better light. So he took it, but begrudgingly a little bit. He took it. At the time, he was taking me, Cash, Max, Wardlow, so many other guys. I'm missing so many other guys. Hobbs. Taking us out to eat, taking us out to dinner, always paying for it, inviting my wife to come along. She came along and my daughter. He would always take us to nice restaurants. He was paying for it, not just me, but everybody. He might not want me to tell you this, but I'll take the heat if he doesn't. He bought all the girls in the locker room Starbucks gift cards and had one of the other girls hand them out anonymously. It didn't say who they were from, but it was from him, just because he loved the atmosphere and he loved being there. He also loved the work the girls were putting in. He thought they were busting their ass to try to get the attention that WWE's women's division was getting." And then he talked about what he believed happened with CM Punk and the Elite during the media scrum from hell at Brawl Out. He said, "So obviously I wasn't there. So who I perceive to be God is the only person who really knows the truth. But everyone, well, I mean, the people in the fucking room would know. But he says, because everybody is going to have their own version in their head, because we've all done it before. We've made up what we perceive to be the truth. What I've heard is what is reported. There are elements of truth in what has been reported. But then there are also some things that raise a red flag to me. Like, man, it seems like we're only getting a portion of the story or what this journalist wants to put out. Whether he has a bias or whether he has a grudge against one of the other parties, that's just how I felt. But I also knew that I didn't know the whole story. I also felt that the stories I had heard from a few people, I don't feel like they would blatantly lie to me. So, you know, I do think there are bits of truth, but I also believe some of the fans have read too much into it, and I think that they should let what happened, let it die down. Because, you know, when all is said and done, I can't tell you that I know 100% of the truth. So I can't tell you if the journalists that are reporting it 100% of the truth, I know what I perceive to be the truth." And, okay, well, we'll end that quote there. Basically, that's a very long-winded way of saying he wasn't there. He wasn't there. He didn't see it. He does not know what happened. But he talked to people, I guess, who were there, and he got the perspective of those people. Now, according to Dax, he was FaceTimed by CM Punk that night after Punk had his locker room scuffle with the Elite. Punk FaceTimed him. I think he was at the hotel in bed or whatever, and he got a FaceTime from CM Punk. So now he's in bed talking to Punk, and he goes, "Dude, are you okay? Do you need me? I'll come right now to help you out or get you cleaned up or whatever." Just trying to picture that. He said that Punk told him, no, everything's fine. It's died down. We're good. He said Punk just wanted him to know what happened before he heard it from someone else. So that's nice that they developed a friendship like that in a short period of time, right? The short period of time that Punk was there, that Dax would be willing to drop everything to go help his buddy out, right? That's a true friend. And I think it's nice that Punk did the things that Dax says that he did, and he wanted to help make AEW a better place overall. No one is saying that CM Punk is the devil incarnate. But then Dax said the following about his desire for things to be worked out between all the parties involved. He says, "This is my plea to all four guys. Please find a way to make it work. If we can make it work, we can set up the future of professional wrestling for a long time, and we can change the course of professional wrestling for a very long time. When you think about it, unselfishly, we're doing this for 20 to 30 years down the road so guys and girls can make a living. Now, there's an Instagram account called the Pro Wrestling Podcast. They posted a part of Dax's quote. And underneath the post, CM Punk, his official account, responded in the comments with one word. Punk wrote, duh. And we don't know whether or not that meant that he was in agreement with what Dax was saying in the quote, or if that was just Punk being sarcastic and he was trying to get people talking for his own amusement. I think that that's a great sentiment from Dax Harwood. Dax seems like his heart's in the right place. He seems like a nice enough chap, right? It's a great sentiment from him. He wasn't bashing anybody. He was being very diplomatic. He's smart enough to know that he has to be. Because while he may be friends with CM Punk, Punk is on the outs right now with AEW. Dax still works there. And he knows that Omega and the Young Bucks are still EVPs in that company. It would be very stupid for him to go on his podcast or somebody else's podcast and speak out against Kenny Omega and the Young Bucks. It would be political suicide. So he is trying to play peacemaker and get the two sides back together to sing Kumbaya. In a perfect world, Punk would apologize. He would apologize for embarrassing the company and embarrassing Tony Khan the way that he did at the media scrum. And he would make money with the Elite. But I don't see that happening. Chris Jericho is said to be one of several top guys in that company who told the rest of the locker room that they would make sure Punk wasn't brought back. Ultimately, it's Tony Khan's call to make. Chris Jericho does not run the company last time I checked. I mean, maybe he thinks he does. But Chris Jericho doesn't run that company. John Moxley, as valuable as he's been for them, does not run that company. Tony Khan runs the company. Tony Khan is the one who signs their checks and pays the bills. Omega and the Bucks being EVPs in the company, that only complicates things. It should not be their call either. But we don't know how much sway they have when it comes to ultimately whatever decision is going to be made. They're EVPs. You would think they have some say. Don't you think that's a conflict of interest? One of the many reasons why I think it was a mistake to dole out those EVP titles in the first place and not strip them away. But they say time heals all wounds. Punk is not going to be around for a while anyway, right? He's still recovering from the injury. It's entirely possible that a few months down the road, if Tony Khan thinks the company needs a real shot in the arm, in a year where they're going to be negotiating their next television rights deal, just like WWE, and they want to get a big increase, right? If Punk wants to stay and is willing to play ball, it's possible that something could be worked out. I'm not saying that it is impossible. I'm saying it is very unlikely. Punk posting a random comment on Instagram is not a sign of anything. If that locker room is as divided as these reports that we've been hearing now for months have suggested on the idea of Punk coming back, and it may not even be that divided, it may be 70-30 or 80-20 in favor of not wanting him back. Tony Khan is better off moving on. Because the things that Punk did, the things that he said, the way that he went off, there's a lot more there to work through than just getting them back in a room and having them shake hands and put this behind them. There's money to be made if they can do it, but it is not so much money that I think it is worth dredging all of this back up again in 6 months. On Friday, William Regal confirmed his AEW departure, and he tweeted a very classy farewell. Said, yesterday was my last official day with AEW. I would like to thank Tony Khan, Mega, who is their head of legal, and all of the hardworking crew. Contrary to people who have never spoken to me or have their information from people who don't know me or are trying to make themselves noticed, I had a lovely time working there, and I had a great time. Lots of talented wrestlers and lovely people to work for. To my fellow BCC members, it was a special, albeit brief, few months, but it cemented our already strong friendship. To everybody there, thank you for welcoming me. Best wishes. So a very classy farewell. As William Regal now, as of today, January 1st, he is officially back working for WWE. He is a vice president in the company. But that was a very nice comment or tweet thread there for him to post. Now, Dynamite coming up on Wednesday is in Seattle, and we are going to get a new look. This is going to be the debut of AEW Dynamite's, and not just Dynamite, but Rampage as well. This is the week where they are debuting a brand new look for their programming on TNT and TBS. New colors and new logos and new ID shots for the wrestlers, a new intro for the show, maybe new music. They're giving the entire show the first really big facelift that it has gotten since the show debuted in 2019. And I said this the other night, already people are complaining just about the little trailer they put out and the fact that they had red and blue. Oh my God, it's WWE, it's Raw and SmackDown, it's Survivor Series colors. What are they copying off WWE? I didn't know WWE had a fucking copyright on the colors red and blue. I guess I better watch my ass because I have red and blue behind me on the wall when I do my live streams on YouTube. Am I going to get a copyright notice from WWE? Calm the fuck down. Let's wait until the shows air this week before we start passing judgment on how it looks or how closely to WWE it looks. The show hasn't even debuted the new look yet. Already people are popping off about it. But it's a loaded show on Wednesday. Chris Jericho one-on-one with Ricky Starks. The Acclaimed defend their tag team titles against Jeff Jarrett and Jay Lethal. Samoa Joe defends the TNT Championship against Darby Allin. Bryan Danielson one-on-one with Tony Nese. And Swerve Strickland takes on AR Fox. Lucha Underground lives. Killshot against... What was AR Fox's name? It was Dante... was it Dante? It was Dante Fox, right? Killshot and Dante Fox. That's right. From Lucha Underground. I love it. Now, Danielson is from Aberdeen. Swerve is from Tacoma. And Darby is from Seattle. So they're all in their home state. Darby is in his hometown. I expect his match to headline the show. I don't see why it wouldn't. Joe already beat Darby once before. So why book the match only to have him beat Darby twice? You know, beating him in his hometown, that's something WWE would do. On Wednesday's review, I cautioned against the idea of them possibly doing a triple threat with Joe, Darby, and Wardlow, because Darby is very popular. And so if the idea was to get the belt back on Wardlow, I think that would blow up in their face if the fans wanted Darby to win. And also, if the goal is to get Wardlow ready to challenge MJF later this year for the championship, and I believe it is, probably a Double or Nothing would make sense. Double or Nothing is going to be 1 year since Wardlow demolished MJF. And he never did get his win back over Wardlow. So it would kind of make sense to build to a Wardlow-MJF main event. They opened the show last year. Maybe they could headline the show this year. But if they're building in that direction, then you know what? It's better not to put the TNT title back on Wardlow. Just to have him lose it again so that he can turn around and challenge MJF. Why put the belt back on him? I mean, he doesn't really need it. He already had it. The fact that they're doing Joe and Darby one-on-one, and after what Joe did to Wardlow on Wednesday, it looks like we're going to have Wardlow cost Samoa Joe the TNT title. So Darby Allin, I think, is going to get another run as the TNT champion, which I'm all for. You know, he was actually something of a ratings draw the last time he was the champion. His segments would go up. They could do that. And Wardlow can wrestle Joe without the title being on the line. Joe cut Wardlow's ponytail off on Wednesday. So hair versus hair as a stipulation would make sense. Ricky Starks, I think, should beat Chris Jericho. Jericho's already lost to Claudio. He lost to Action Andretti. But he can eat losses. Starks does not have the same tenure that Jericho has. And he already lost to MJF. He said he was going to go in there and take the championship from Max. From MaxiPad, and he didn't do it. He lost. I would not have Ricky Starks lose twice in a row. But I can totally see them doing it if they want to have a program that extends into Revolution. It's just not something that I would do. I think there's a way to do the match and have some kind of a fluky finish or, you know, Starks, even if the finish is fluky, but he wins and then he gets attacked after the match. You can keep this thing going without beating him. I would not beat Ricky Starks. Now, the Wednesday after that is the January 11th Dynamite from the Forum in Los Angeles. Another big show. That is shaping up to be a big one for them. One of the things, according to the Observer, is that there will be key officials expected to be there, given that they're in Los Angeles. officials from Warner Brothers Discovery, who will likely be in attendance at that show, as they were back in June when they made their LA debut. Remember when they made their LA debut on June 1st? And Tony Khan was talking about how they had the big after party with all the executives, right? This great big party. So they may be doing that again this time. We have, not this week, but next week in LA, Game 7. The final match in the Best of 7 series to determine who the Trios champions will be. The current champions, Death Triangle, defending against the Elite. It's going to be a ladder match. They have not announced it, but they are teasing the possibility of Jon Moxley one-on-one with Hangman Page on that show. And then there's the match they announced weeks ago and have not mentioned since. Britt Baker and Jamie Hayter against Saraya and a mystery partner. It has not even been mentioned since then on television. Now, I think Saraya and Britt had travel issues that prevented them from being in Colorado this week. So that's why they were not on the show. But that would not have stopped having Excalibur talk about the match on commentary, and it was never mentioned. So they're going to have an update on Saraya's partner, they say, on Wednesday. We'll get some kind of update. I said it before, I'll say it again. If they're keeping it a surprise, they better have a big name up their sleeve. Otherwise, just announce Toni Storm and be done with it. She would make the most sense given that her issue with Jamie Hayter is not dead yet. Speaking of big shows, we have a pretty big one coming up on Wednesday, and I'm not just talking about Dynamite, but even before that, early on Wednesday morning, Wrestle Kingdom 17, which always is a fun way to kick off the year. We always get at least a couple of early Match of the Year contenders. This year, the main card at the Tokyo Dome is only one night. It's been two nights the past couple of years, but this time it's just one night. I don't know when I will review the show. My plan is to go live at some point in the afternoon on Wednesday. I am probably not going to stay up at 3 o'clock in the morning to watch this show. I'll watch it later in the morning. So I have no idea when I'll be done watching it. When I am, I will likely be live on YouTube to review it and then live on YouTube a second time that night after Dynamite. So it's going to be a very busy day on Wednesday. Follow me on Twitter at Solomonster. I'll keep you guys posted. But what I want to do here is I want to run through the card real quick and give you my predictions for each of the matches. We have an Antonio Inoki Memorial six-man tag. Inoki, of course, the father of New Japan, passed away in October. Last year was the 50th anniversary of New Japan, so they're having a memorial match in his honor. Togi Makabe, Satoshi Kojima, and Yuji Nagata take on Tatsumi Fujinami, Tiger Mask, and Minoru Suzuki. And I'm going with Makabe, Kojima, and Nagata. IWGP Junior Heavyweight Tag Team titles on the line. We have Francesco Akira and TJP defending against Leo Rush and Yo. Last week, Akira attacked Yo at their Corkin Hall show. I think Leo and Yo take the tag team titles. We have the IWGP Women's Championship being defended at the Tokyo Dome for the very first time, with Kairi making her first defense right here on this big stage, against Tam Nakano. And this is the match where I, as most people, I think, expect that we are going to get the appearance of Mercedes Moné, who is now a free agent. It is January 1st, although I think last I checked this morning, she is still listed on the WWE roster. They have not moved her to the alumni section, but it's Sunday morning, though, so I don't think they have their web team working on Sunday morning, not working like me. But she is officially a free agent now. Sasha Banks is free. And Sasha Banks is currently over in Japan. I'm sure she's just there on vacation. I've heard, by the way, you know, as far as the best time of year to be in Japan, that this apparently is one of the worst times of year. And if people who have been in Japan, feel free to correct me, but I've not been there. But apparently this is one of the worst times, if not the worst time of year to be there, because I guess everything just shuts down around Christmas and New Year's. And if you're there on vacation and you're hoping to, you know, hit up certain places as a tourist, it's almost impossible to. So I always figure, you know, if I'm able to eventually make it to Japan, I think it would be cool to go in the summertime when they do the G1, hit up a couple of or maybe more than a couple of the G1 shows. See, to me, I think that would be more fun. Being at the Tokyo Dome would be cool, but I feel like that might be more fun. But she's over there. Maybe she's on vacation. Maybe it's just a big coincidence. But no, I expect her to come out here when this match is over. Kairi is going to win. Kairi is going to retain her title. Mercedes is going to show up. I don't know if they'll, you know, cut a promo and make the challenge or if they'll just do a stare down, but I think this will lead to a championship match. I know there's a big U.S. show coming up in San Jose next month, I think on the 18th. A lot of people think that that might be where they do the match. There's another night of Wrestle Kingdom, I think at Yokohama, coming up later this month. They could very well do the match there. But we will get an IWGP women's title match between Mercedes and Kairi, without question. Now, there is a major Stardom show that apparently is going to be announced, or I think it was already announced, for April 23rd at the Yokohama Arena. I think Sasha is committed to that show. So whatever happens with her and Kairi and the IWGP belt, if nothing else, I don't think they would wait that long to do the match with her and Kairi, but apparently that big show for Stardom in April is something that Sasha is already committed to. We have Zack Sabre Jr. taking on Ren Narita to crown the first ever IWGP, is it IWGP? I'm not sure if it is, or if they're just calling it the New Japan television title. It may not be IWGP, as if New Japan doesn't have enough titles. Right, we complain about this with AEW. You can say the same thing about New Japan. So they're creating a new television title. And I don't have any reason to believe that Zack Sabre Jr. will not be the first TV champion. He is my pick. We have the junior heavyweight title being defended. Taiji Ishimori defending against Hiromu Takahashi, El Desperado, and Master Wato in a four-way match. It looked as if they were heading towards something with Ishimori and Kushida. I was trying to keep up with what the hell's going on with Kushida. I haven't heard about him in a while. Apparently, he's been sick. I know he had hand, foot, and mouth disease a few months ago. I don't know if it's lingering issues from that or if he got sick with something else. He's not on this show. And I would think they're going to want to do Kushida and Ishimori once he's ready to come back. So I don't see there being a title change here. I think Ishimori will retain. We have the IWGP Tag Team titles on the line. FTR, our old boy Dax, Dax and Cash, going to defend their titles for the first time at the Tokyo Dome against Yoshihashi and Hirooki Goto. FTR just dropped their Ring of Honor tag belts at Final Battle. They've been on a losing streak recently in AEW. They lost to the Acclaimed when they challenged for the titles a few weeks ago. And they just lost their AAA Tag Team titles to Dragon Lee and Dralístico on Wednesday night in Mexico. This has not been a good run the last several weeks for FTR. This has been a nightmare of a month for Dax and Cash. I think the nightmare continues. I think they're going to drop their belts. I think Yoshihashi and Hirooki Goto will be the new tag team champions. Carl Anderson defends his never open weight championship against Tama Tonga. This is also something that if Vince McMahon were still in power, we would not be seeing. Carl Anderson either would not be back in WWE, or Carl Anderson would have had to have given up and surrendered the title months ago. But it's a new day, right? It's a new day. Yes, it is. And so they worked out a deal where Carl Anderson could come back to WWE, but could keep the never open weight title and eventually, I presume, drop it at the Tokyo Dome. And that's exactly what I expect him to do. There's no reason to think he's not dropping it here. Tama Tonga will be the new champion. Keiji Muto will have his last match ever in New Japan as Keiji Muto, teaming up with Hiroshi Tanahashi and Shota Umino against Bushi, Sanada, and Tetsuya Naito. So from wrestling Shinsuke Nakamura as the Great Muta this morning to his final New Japan appearance as Keiji Muto, it's going to be a big week for him. I think the teacher puts over his pupil, and Sanada pins Muto with a moonsault. I remember when Seiya Sanada made his big debut in Impact Wrestling, right? When he was in TNA, all those many years ago. And they talked about him being a student of the Great Muta. So I think it would be appropriate for him to be the one to get the winning fall on his teacher. And then we have the two main events. For some people, this might just be the main event. For the IWGP United States Championship, Will Ospreay defending against Kenny Omega. Kenny Omega's first match in New Japan in years. His return to the Tokyo Dome. Former IWGP heavyweight champion. This is a big deal. Getting Omega back in New Japan. I don't see it being a successful night for him. I think Will Ospreay is going to retain the U.S. title. But this is the match I am most looking forward to. You put Kenny Omega in the ring with Will. You put Will Ospreay in the ring with almost anybody, let alone Kenny Omega. If we get the Kenny Omega of old, the New Japan Kenny Omega, the cleaner Kenny Omega, you're going to have an early match of the year contender right here. But Will Ospreay is going to win. And then in the actual main event, the IWGP World Heavyweight title on the line, Jay White, Switchblade, defends against the former champion, Kazuchika Okada, the winner of the G1 Climax, back in the main event at the Tokyo Dome, a place where he is very familiar with being. We get big match Okada in the Tokyo Dome. There ain't nothing better than that. And I don't have any doubt in my mind that Okada is going to walk out with the championship. I think Okada will become the new IWGP World Heavyweight Champion. I know this run that Jay White has had. I like Jay White, but it just feels, I don't know, kind of cold. We were talking about this on the New Year's Eve stream last night. It feels pretty cold to me, and it just feels like they're going to want to go with their tried and true. And I think there's a story to tell with Will Ospreay beating Okada clean in the middle of the ring. No help, no interference, no distraction. He still has yet to do that. No matter how many matches they have, the only win he ever has over Okada, and it did not come clean. I think it's part of a longer story they're telling. I don't know that Okada is going to win the title and hold on to it for a year. But I think a year from now, it's very likely we are looking at Okada defending that championship in the main event at the Tokyo Dome against Will Ospreay. And they could be setting up for Ospreay to get his big win there. I think it's part of a longer story they're telling. But I think Okada is going to win the championship. That is the lineup for Wrestle Kingdom. Very much looking forward to the show. Have no idea when I'll get to watch the entire thing that day, but I will watch it. We will talk about it. It's going to be a very busy week. And I hope that you are subscribed on YouTube, because when I go live, if you're busy, if you're working, if you're doing something else, you should get a notification. Make sure, if you are not subbed, that you are subbed this week. NXT this week had the Battle for the Bar with Fallon Henley and Kiana James, which in the end amounted to absolutely nothing. For a match that had such supposedly high stakes, it was amazingly anticlimactic, with Henley winning, so she and her parents get to keep serving Ric Flair. But it did spawn a new wrinkle in the storyline, as Brooks Jensen seemed visibly bummed at the finish over Kiana losing the match, even though he's, you know, with Fallon Henley, right? It's Briggs and Jensen and Fallon, they're a trio on this show, because he's smitten with her. Jensen is smitten with Kiana James. I have seen this storyline before. And so did Shawn Michaels, because he was working on top as the champion at the time when it happened. It was when Sonny was managing the Smoking Guns, and Billy Gunn grew very smitten with her. Which is not hard to believe, because back then, I mean, she was a total smoke show. So Billy Gunn got very smitten with Sonny. Ultimately, she dumped them when they lost the tag team titles, but it led to the breakup of Billy and Bart. So for Jensen's sake, he better hope that doesn't happen here, because without this team, he would be dead in the water. Julius Creed and JD McDonagh, they had a good opener. They clearly see singles potential in Julius. I'm not there yet. I mean, I hope when they get called up, we get a proper tag team run for the Creeds. And I'm sure we will, but he looked good here. They're finally doing the Creeds against Veer and Sangha at New Year's Evil next week. For those unaware, they have kept Veer out of the ring. He was dealing with, I believe, what was said to be a minor hand injury. But they wanted to be extra cautious with him because of the live event they had scheduled in India on the 18th. They didn't want to run the risk of Veer getting hurt and then he and Sangha not being on that show. As it turns out, the India event has been postponed, according to Dave Meltzer, because WWE's Indian broadcast partner Sony 6 is merging with Z Entertainment, and Sony decided to hold off on the show until after the merger is completed. That probably won't happen until at least April, so there's no longer any need to hold them out of the ring. Ikem and Jiro was very upset with Scripps. Yes, it was Reggie in his awful costume and his new gimmick, although he made some alterations to the outfit so it was less shitty, but still not totally devoid of shittiness. Kind of like a diet soda with less sugar, but it's still terrible for you. Scripps recently stole Eichemann's jacket, and he wanted it back. Because evidently that's the only sport coat that the man owns. That's because he's making NXT money and not that sweet main roster money. You see, Dragon Lee, this is what your future looks like. So they had a match. Scripps won, and then he just laid the jacket across Jiro's body and gave it back to him. Just like that. So what was the fucking point of taking it in the first place if he was just going to beat him and give it back to him? Yet another New Generation era WWE storyline, by the way. Recycled by Shawn Michaels. I am sensing a pattern here. At least in that story, Bret Hart beat the pirate and he got his leather jacket back. We had the second appearance of Lyra Valkyria, this time against Lash Legend, who did not look like a complete disaster in the ring this time. That's the best compliment I can give her. She's still very rough. She's learning, but she's still very rough. Valkyria used a splash for the win, but it's like, it looked like less of a splash off the top and more like she just sort of fell off the top rope. I hope that's what happened, and that's not actually how the movie's going to look every time she does it. Gigi Dolin and JC Jane, they were shown sitting in their VIP lounge backstage, and they were talking about still being the attraction of NXT. Gigi said that people keep writing them off, but they have reached superstardom, and JC said that they are going to rebuild and return to glory. And she said that they need to take down the woman who took down their empire, that being Roxanne Perez. They did their damnedest as they showed all of the toxic attraction footage to keep Mandy Rose out of it as much as they possibly could. I also saw where Meltzer said that Gigi and JC were due for a main roster call-up without Mandy anyway, before she got released. I don't buy that. If they did get called up without her, it would have only been temporary until she dropped the title, and then she would have been called up right along with them. It would have made no sense not to call up all three members of Toxic Attraction, so I don't buy that. They did a segment with Drew Gulak. It was the Drew Gulak Invitational. I like this segment. He was in the ring with Hank Walker. Now, for those of you who don't know who Hank Walker is, this was their way of introducing one of the new talents to NXT television. Hank Walker was a backstage security guy who ultimately, you know, he got involved and he ended up wrestling a match, and now he wants to learn how to be a professional wrestler, right? He's the supposed security guy who won a WWE contract a little while back. So Hank wanted to observe as Drew Gulak got in the ring with three indie wrestlers, one by one. Gulak had a headset mic on, like he was DDP back when he was doing the gimmick that he was doing when he was the motivational speaker, or Simon Dean when he used to come out and have the headset. Remember Muffy? I swear to God, there was a woman named Muffy on SmackDown. She may have literally only made one appearance, now that I think about it, on WWE television. I could have sworn that she was supposed to be Stephanie McMahon's personal trainer. That was her gimmick. I still remember Muffy. I don't know, some people just stand out to me, but anyway, I think Muffy also had a headset mic. But Drew Gulak, he is no Muffy. But he called the first wrestler over. He shook Gulak's hand. And Gulak demonstrated a crossface chicken wing on him. Gulak then talked about how important it was as he was teaching Hank. He says, very important to make sure that after the tap, you let go of the hold. So that's what he did. Then he trained with Tavian, the amateur wrestler. And both men had very short exhibition. Gulak got a heel hook for the tap out. And then the third man was Miles Bourne, who has made appearances on NXT's Level Up show. I believe he is the first deaf wrestler ever signed by WWE. Both men traded lockups. Miles was able to really not outclass Gulak, but you know, he gave him more than he was expecting. Not that he embarrassed him, but Gulak wasn't expecting that to be as competitive as it was. And so he got a dragon sleeper on Miles for the tap out, but he wouldn't let go of the hold, right? He was breaking his own rules. So Hank had to come over and get Gulak off of Miles Bourne. So now we have Charlie Dempsey comes out, the son of William Regal, comes down to the ring. He says, if Gulak wants to step up to a real wrestler, he could give him a run for his money. And Gulak noted that Dempsey was not invited to this, and Hank tried to play peacemaker between the two of them, and Dempsey proposed a match with Hank on TV next week. And so Gulak agreed on his behalf, and he said that Hank would be ready. So I like the segment. I like the story that they're telling here. It's a different way to try to introduce somebody. Everybody on this brand has some kind of gimmick. Everything is very... You could tell Shawn Michaels, you know, in this company, he came up in that era, in the era of the gimmicks. A couple of times on this show alone, there were some callbacks to New Generation era storylines. So it's not surprising that Shawn Michaels is the one running creative on this show. He's got his fingerprints all over it. But I think it's a smart way, I think, to try to introduce this guy and to use somebody like Drew Gulak, not in a comedy role. We're so used to seeing him doing comedy stuff and being the butt of jokes and being beaten up and doing 24/7, you know, sprints around the arena. Gulak is a serious wrestler, and so they used him in a way that I think made sense for him, and I'm curious where the story goes. And then we had Wesley retaining his North American championship over Tony D'Angelo. The last time we saw these two in the ring together was in September when D'Angelo hurt his knee. I think that was a qualifying match for what was the big North American championship ladder match, because Solo Sikoa had been stripped by Shawn Michaels. And that's where Tony D got hurt. They had a good match. Lee is starting to string together some key wins. Dijak came out late in the match to kidnap Tony D's boy, Stax. And he took him to the back. He dragged him to the back. D'Angelo got pinned, but this being his first long match back from the injury, he went 15 minutes. I thought he looked good. And I'm glad that it appears Dijak is not just going to be used as hired muscle for D'Angelo. So look, you know, NXT closes the year out a shell of what it used to be, but you can see the talent that has potential and could be primed for main roster call-ups in the next 6 months. And the ones who need a lot more seasoning than that, they're going to get that. So you can see. You can see kind of where the pieces are falling when it comes to some of these talents. Now, I watched the Ric Flair documentary that aired on Peacock. It's a nearly 2 hour long documentary. They had Tom Rinaldi in there, who was the narrator and the one asking the questions as Flair sat there in a chair and was interviewed about all kinds of different topics. They had a whole bunch of different talking heads in this thing. Hulk Hogan, Steve Austin, Triple H, Shawn Michaels, Mike Tyson, Stephen A. Smith, Post Malone, Booker T, DDP, Charlotte, Bruce Pritchard, Eric Bischoff, a whole bunch of different people. And it really boiled down to a very simple question. Who is Richard Flair and who is Ric Flair? And it's very clear, as Ric Flair has talked about, he doesn't know who that guy is. I'm not sure Richard Flair really even exists anymore. There's Ric Flair, and other than that, you know, there really is nobody else at this point. It's kind of all just one and the same. But I thought, you know, the documentary, it was well done, but if you saw Flair's 30 for 30 that was done a number of years ago, or if you just know anything about his life and his career, I don't think you're going to get much in the way of new information out of this documentary. And the 30 for 30, that was a 90-minute special that ESPN aired several years ago. And I talked about it, I reviewed it on the podcast at the time, and that was a very good documentary. I felt like they didn't whitewash the man's career. And I liked the animations and the reenactments in that one that they used. But Flair has made comments in recent weeks that this documentary would blow that one out of the water. He said, I'm just going to blow my 30 for 30 out of the water. I wouldn't go that far. I wouldn't say it blew it out of the water. And as far as new information, one thing that we did learn, and Flair himself only just learned this 3 years ago, he says, was what his birth name was. Up until 3 years ago, Ric Flair says he did not know what his birth name was because he was adopted. His birth name was Fred Phillips. Doesn't quite have the same ring as Ric Flair, but he was born Fred Phillips, and he found out through social media. This was fairly recently. Someone reached out to Ric's wife, Wendy. Although they're not really legally married, so technically they're not husband and wife. They had a ceremony, but they're not really married. But somebody reached out to Wendy to let her know that he was born to the same birth mother of Rick. So basically to let Rick know that he has a brother that he never knew of before. And he wasn't looking for anything. He wasn't asking for money or, you know, he just wanted to reach out because maybe he just found this information out himself. You know, they have all these people doing these DNA tests and everything. Who knows, right? The information that people can find out today is crazy. But Rick said he opted not to meet him. He wanted to meet with him, and Rick said, "Nah, I have no interest. Tell him I'm not interested in meeting with him." His logic was, "I'm 73 years old. I'm not curious about the past. I've always looked at myself as an only child. I'm 73. What's the point in meeting this person who is a total stranger to me?" So he had no interest in meeting this guy. But they had footage of a 60 Minutes report from Mike Wallace many years ago about black market babies. And apparently the orphanage that Flair was in when he was a kid was one of the places that babies stolen from their mothers were illegally sold. So it is very likely that Ric Flair was a black market baby. So that was kind of interesting. I did not know that. I was not aware of that previously. And that was all addressed at the very beginning of the documentary. You could have turned it off at that point. You're not going to learn anything new after this. It's only really going to reinforce, I think, what your existing views of Ric Flair may be. You know, they covered a lot of the stuff you would expect. They covered the plane crash in 1975, as I have many times before, where he broke his back in three places, and then he was back in the ring 4 months later. They addressed the Four Horsemen and Flair living the gimmick, him leaving WCW to go work for the WWF and winning the Royal Rumble, and Bruce Pritchard saying that none of the WWF fans at the time knew who Flair was, so that he wasn't a big deal there as much as he was in WCW. Which is something that Flair himself does not dispute. That, you know, there were a lot of WWF fans who didn't watch Mid-Atlantic, and they didn't watch World Class when he would appear, and they didn't watch World Championship Wrestling, and they didn't know from Ric Flair and what made this guy such a big deal. That's true. I was aware of who Ric Flair was, but did I have an appreciation for how big of a star he was at that time when I was that age? No. No, to me, the stars were Hulk Hogan and Andre the Giant, and the Macho Man, and the Ultimate Warrior, and the Million Dollar Man, and Jake the Snake, and people like that. I was aware of Flair and Sting and the Road Warriors, but unless you were watching that at that time, you couldn't have, I think, a full appreciation for how big those guys were. So I don't think that's an unfair point to make. The point that Flair did dispute, that Pritchard said that when Rick came in, he thought he was going to be the biggest star, or he wanted to be the biggest star there. Flair said he never went there with the idea that he would be the biggest star. He went there because he just wanted to get the hell away from Jim Herd. After the way that he was treated in WCW and the way that all went down, he just wanted out. So that he disputes. The Flair to this day admits that Hulk Hogan was the bigger star than he was. Hogan, meanwhile, in every interview, including in this documentary, goes out of his way to call Flair the greatest of all time. Even better than me. He's the greatest of all time. And I want to believe that he believes that, because he says it so much. The problem is, it's Hogan. It's hard to believe anything that comes out of the man's mouth. He certainly didn't put Flair over when they worked together, and they worked together dozens of times. But they covered Rick helping to bring in people like Hogan and Savage to WCW. It wasn't Bischoff that did that. Ultimately, really, it was Flair. Flair's the one who made inroads with those guys to help bring them into the company. They covered the rise of the NWO, all the times that Eric Bischoff fucked with Ric Flair, including suing him for breach of contract when Flair no-showed an episode of Thunder to attend his son's wrestling tournament. Flair has always maintained that he asked for that time off well in advance. Bischoff says otherwise, and he basically threatened to bankrupt Flair for it. He was going to make an example out of him, all because he missed a Thunder, to go to his son's wrestling tournament. They covered his return to WWE, the formation of Evolution, his retirement match with Shawn Michaels. No mention of his TNA run. As far as anybody knows, if you watch this, he ended his career against Shawn Michaels at WrestleMania 24. Although they did mention at the very end that he came out of retirement for one last match in July, and then he was involved in another match in Puerto Rico, and that he tweeted in September, "I will never retire." That's how they ended the documentary. Then they covered his son Reed's death in 2013. They played the 911 call Flair made, which is still very disturbing to listen to. They talked about his four marriages. I mean, the man who has paid more in alimony than Vince McMahon did to buy WCW. This is a man who cheated death at least three different times. right? A plane crash, a lightning strike, and over 30 days in ICU, where doctors gave him a 15% chance of survival. Actually, I should say more than one lightning strike, if he's to be believed. He didn't mention this in the documentary, but he has claimed that he has been struck not once, but twice by lightning. The first time was in 1982, when he was the NWA champion. He was working matches with Ricky Steamboat. He had a match with Steamboat that night that he was scheduled for. And he was flying Eastern Airlines into Richmond, Virginia. His plane lands, and they are not letting anybody off the plane because it's raining so hard. Once the rain let up, they let the people off, and they gave them umbrellas as they came off the plane. Well, a bolt of lightning hit the, he claims, a bolt of lightning hit the top of Flair's umbrella, which sent the umbrella 50 feet up into the air. But apparently that bolt of lightning then bounced off the umbrella and it hit the guy behind Flair in the eye and killed him. Now, I have tried to find any news clippings that I possibly can about this because this is just an unbelievable story. Given somebody died, you would think there'd be a record of this somewhere. I can't find anything. It's almost too unbelievable to even think about. Right? And maybe I'm just jaded. I just watched an entire season of Tales from the Territories. How many fucking stories about eyeballs being plucked out of people's heads, right? We all know wrestlers, especially old school wrestlers, they tell tall tales. It's hard for me to believe. You know, at least, look, the plane crash would be hard to believe if it wasn't documented, which it is. But this story is just unbelievable. But he has also claimed that there was a second time he was flying on a small plane. This was in 86. And I guess lightning hit the plane. And he claims that they went upside down. The moral of the story is, when it comes to plane rides, don't ride with Ric Flair. Bad things happen. Case in point, speaking of plane rides, one thing that was omitted from this documentary, and ordinarily I would say it's not surprising, right? I mean, why would they put this in there? Unless they wanted to do a truly balanced piece. Why would they voluntarily put this in there? But I bring this up because Flair himself has brought this up. He was on his podcast. This was only in November. So this was not months and months and months ago. This is fairly recently. Flair was on his podcast, and he was talking about the documentary. And he claimed that the documentary would address what happened with the whole plane ride from hell fiasco. This is what he said at the time. He said, "One of the most difficult things I've ever been through in my life, personally, aside from health issues, is having 85,000 people text me within 2 minutes that I was no longer on the opening of Raw or SmackDown after that bullshit from Plane Ride to Hell came out, which is all bullshit. It is explained thoroughly in my new documentary. I mean thoroughly. I am calling some people out big time." This is what he said on his own podcast. Now, on Flair's latest podcast, since the documentary has been released, they posted the video version of his podcast on the YouTube channel they have for it. And they have timestamps. Well, there's one where he is asked specifically, did they leave anything out of the documentary that got cut or that you wanted to have in there? No mention of the plane ride from hell stuff or rebutting the allegations or anything like that, which is for the better. I mean, let's be honest. If you're Ric Flair, I wouldn't want to bring that shit up either if I were him. But why did he say that it would be addressed and explained thoroughly and he would be calling people out, presumably, you know, that he feels lied, and then there's nothing in the document? So he's full of shit, basically. He's full of shit. But they cover his health issues as well and all the health issues that he has had. And he still drinks. He says he just wastes time until 5 o'clock every day. Because 5 o'clock is happy hour. I guess you do that sort of thing when you've been drinking since the age of 15. But the man is 73 now. And he just doesn't learn. Even though he has had plenty of scares and has gotten more chances than most people could ever ask for, he still has not learned his lesson. This is a man who spent over a month in rehab, got his sobriety coin, walked outside and right into a bar a block away. And he laughs about it. Like it's all just a big joke to him. It's a joke to him. Except all the hell that he put his family through and his friends through, especially when he almost died in the hospital and he was laying in there for 32 days. So when this thing was over, again, I didn't learn much in the way of anything new. It pretty much reinforced all the stories about him that we've heard and whatever your thoughts are about the man. You know, you separate the two out. Ric Flair, as an attraction, as a professional wrestler, as a world heavyweight champion. When I think of what a world champion looks like, I think of Ric Flair. It is hard to argue against Flair being the greatest of all time. If he's not the greatest, he's in the conversation. And I can separate the man from the performer, and I can sit here and say that. Flair has had an incredible career. He's lived a very charmed life and has had an amazing career over a very long period of time. And I have a lot of fond memories of matches that he was involved in. I talk often about the 1992 Royal Rumble because it is the greatest Royal Rumble of all time and will never be topped. But when you hear these stories about him and you see it laid out there like it was here in this documentary, even though there were certain things that they did not cover, right? Like the plane ride from hell stuff, which became a big news story again this past year when it was brought up by Dark Side of the Ring. You hear these stories about him and his behavior and the things that he has said about people. He went off recently on Jim Ross because Jim Ross made a comment. It might have been on the Dark Side of the Ring episode. Something about, oh God, what was the comment that Jim Ross, and it wasn't even like a bad comment, but he was so offended by this, was Flair. He went on his podcast and he said, you know, and he brought up Jim Ross and he said, you know, even though JR calls me the greatest of all time, he said, I've lost all, and he goes like, oh, Jim Ross lost his wife. And I know that was a tough thing for him. And I introduced him to his wife. I introduced him to Jan and he calls me the greatest of all time. But because JR made this one comment on that episode, which he was absolutely right in what he said, I just can't remember what it was, the way he phrased it, it offended Flair so much that he said, I've lost any and all respect I've ever had for Jim Ross. Because he made that one comment about Flair. It was something about like how hard it is to be his friend or something like that. That's what he said about Jim Ross. He's been going off now the last 2 weeks about Eric Bischoff. Because of a comment that Bischoff made in the documentary. And Bischoff has gone out and said, I have no idea what set this guy off. He and I have had a rocky relationship over the years, but in recent times, even just a matter of months ago, we were at some kind of convention. He texted me, come down to the bar, let's hang out. And everything seemed to be cool between us. And now Flair's been going off on him, calling him all kinds of shit, dredging up past issues. This guy doesn't know what he's talking about. He used to sell meat from the back of a truck. And there are people who think it's all a work. I've watched some of these clips of Flair. He's not that good of an actor. Flair can be talking about something completely unrelated, and then he'll bring Bischoff up out of nowhere. And you watch him and his body language. The thing that really strikes me when I watch this documentary, for all of the success that this man has had over all of these years, and as revered as he still is by so many people, even in pop culture, and they covered that too in the documentary, he's in rap videos, he's got his own line of cannabis, he's at these award shows, right? He's at different sporting events in the locker room giving a pep talk to the team, like everyone woos, right? He's this pop culture icon. He may be the most insecure person I have ever seen in my entire life. The insecurity issues that this man has had, really, it sounds like since he was much younger, I mean, it is incredible. And then the two different times in WCW and then again when he came to WWE where he lost confidence in himself and Triple H was trying to get him out of his funk. You're Ric Flair. What do you have to, you know, not be confident about? These self-confidence issues and insecurities that he has had, I mean, it shines through like a bright light when you watch this documentary. So that was something else that really jumped out at me. Flair seems to me like he's a transactional guy. If he can get something out of you, if you're nice to him, he'll be nice to you. There are a lot of stories I don't need to get into about him stiffing companies and people on payments over the years and stuff. And he himself has talked about being in IRS trouble and not paying his taxes. And Vince McMahon has bailed him out multiple times on that front. And Vince McMahon has been very, very nice to Ric Flair over the years. And Vince is another one. The WWE is another one where if they do something that bothers him, They took him out of the intro for Raw and SmackDown. I mean, you would think they declared World War III on this man and how this company is a disgrace, the way they disgraced me. It's all about him. And if you fall out of line with him or you make a comment that he doesn't like, it's almost like you're dead to him. It's very transactional in that way. What can you do for Ric Flair? So as a performer, absolutely the GOAT, one of the GOATs. As a husband and as a human being, that's a very different story. To piggyback on this, Ricky Steamboat was giving an interview to Bill Apter on Sports Keita. And Steamboat revealed the real reason that he turned down the chance to wrestle Ric Flair in Flair's final match in July after initially agreeing to do so. He said, initially, Conrad, who is the promoter, we talked, and I went to Nashville. We had a sit-down. It was Conrad, his wife, me and my wife. I was still training pretty good and feeling pretty good, so I said okay. And we hadn't signed and sealed the deal or the money part of it. But what put the nail in the coffin was a week after that when I found out that Flair was wearing a pacemaker. All these years, I never knew. And I immediately just said, I don't think I want to do this. I don't want my legacy to be that I was in the ring when he happened to pass away or something went wrong. He says, I didn't want that. I've done some interviews after that when they found out that I said no. But this is the first time that I've come public with this. I didn't want to throw Conrad or Flair under the bus, so I threw myself under the bus. Even when I was talking with you, that I'm not the guy that the fans remember me by. And that's true. And I even said at the time he was doing one of those virtual signings with High Spots, and the promoter asked him about that. And he said, yeah, no, you know, it's not going to happen because I just don't want people to think less of me. I want them to remember me the way they remember me being in the ring with Chris Jericho when I came back in 2009. And that's a fine excuse, except for the fact that Steamboat just came back and did his first match, his retirement match, tagging with FTR at a big time wrestling show back in November. Right? So it's almost like, wait a minute, you didn't want to come back and have people remember you now instead of the way you used to be. And then 3 months later or 4 months later, you're back in the ring. And so now it makes a lot more sense. You know, it was a bullshit excuse. He just didn't want to be in the ring with Rick because, like a lot of people, they were worried that this fucking guy was going to drop dead. And there were moments during that match where I was worried that he was going to drop dead in the middle of the ring in front of a live crowd. The end of that match, when he was sucking wind and couldn't even get oxygen into his lungs, was fucking scary. Andrade had to physically put the brass knuckles on his hand for him. I don't blame Steamboat for feeling that way. But at least now we know the real reason why. All right, now, each year, on the Sound Off, we do the annual prediction show, where we look back at what I got right and what I got wrong the year before. I hold myself accountable. How many podcast hosts can say that they do that? Not very many. And then I look ahead to the future and what I see happening in the wrestling world in 2023. Lucky you, today is that day. First, let's look back at my predictions for 2022. As always, shout out to Byron from upstate New York for the assist on some of these, what I got right and what I got very wrong. I predicted that Bobby Lashley would beat Brock Lesnar to become WWE champion at the Royal Rumble with an assist from Paul Heyman and/or the Bloodline. And I was right on all fronts. Heyman was out there with Brock. Roman Reigns came out. Heyman handed him the WWE title. Roman used it to knock out Lesnar, give Lashley the assist. I also predicted that Lesnar would then enter the Royal Rumble match later that night and win the whole thing and go on to WrestleMania to challenge Roman Reigns for the championship. And I nailed that one as well. I predicted that Bianca Belair would win her second straight Royal Rumble match to get her revenge on Becky Lynch at WrestleMania and win the Raw Women's Championship, which is exactly what happened. But I also said that Alexa Bliss would get her own revenge by eliminating Charlotte Flair in the Royal Rumble, which did not happen. And I also said that Sasha Banks would defeat Charlotte at WrestleMania to win the SmackDown Women's title in Dallas, the same city where she and Becky first lost to Charlotte back at WrestleMania 32. That did not happen. I guess Sasha could always try again this year, but if she's smart, she'll stay far away. I predicted that Randy Orton and Matt Riddle would lose their Raw Tag Team titles to Seth Rollins and Kevin Owens at WrestleMania. They lost their titles to the Alpha Academy on the January 10th episode of Raw, probably a week after I did my predictions. I predicted that Austin Theory would be the man to take the United States Championship from Damian Priest at WrestleMania, and Priest would then be competing for the WWE title by the summer. Oops. I predicted that Sean Waltman, who had recently announced that he was getting back in the ring, I predicted that there would be a spot waiting for him in the Men's Royal Rumble match as a surprise entrant. He was not in the Rumble, but he did wrestle twice last year for GCW. I predicted the WWE Women's Royal Rumble match would not be the only time that we would see Mickie James back on TV for them after they induct her into their 2022 Hall of Fame class. And that did not happen. I predicted that Bron Breakker would be on Raw or SmackDown no later than the draft in October, as would Walter and Imperium. There was no draft in October, but I was technically right, because Bron Breakker did wrestle a couple of matches on Monday Night Raw, including a win over Dolph Ziggler when he won back the NXT Championship, and I was right about Imperium moving up to the main roster. I predicted that NXT 2.0 would not survive the year in its current slot on USA Network. It would either get moved to a different time or moved off of USA entirely and onto Peacock. NXT 2.0 did not survive the year, yet the show itself lives on USA. I predicted that Samoa Joe, Keith Lee, Killer Cross and Scarlett, Johnny Gargano, and Ember Moon would all end up working for AEW. I was half right. I got 3 out of the 6. Had Vince McMahon not stepped down, I would have gotten them all right. I predicted that CM Punk and MJF would meet for the first time at Revolution in March, with MJF handing Punk his first loss, and then beating Hangman Page to win the title at Double or Nothing. MJF did beat Punk. He did hand him his first loss, but he beat him on Dynamite, and then Punk won the rematch at Revolution. Punk then beat Hangman at Double or Nothing, not MJF. I predicted that Darby Allin would beat Bryan Danielson at Double or Nothing, and then later in the year, Darby would climb back into the ring with MJF and would take the AEW World title away from him. It did not play out that way. I predicted that Sting would get his first and only shot at the AEW World Championship, either on a major episode of Dynamite or one of their Battle of the Belt specials. They would tug at the heartstrings of all the Sting fans, all little Stingers out there. But MJF would break their hearts and beat him, which is when Sting's son Darby would avenge him and would win the title from MJF at Full Gear. I still think that would be a great setup. I think that would be a great setup to Darby getting a crack at MJF for the world title. And it would give Tony Khan an actual major match to promote on one of those useless Battle of the Belt shows. They're doing another one this Friday. I think it's a live Rampage and a live Battle of the Belt special this Friday. No matches announced so far. I predicted that CM Punk would feud with Jon Moxley, which he did. I predicted that Kenny Omega and the Young Bucks would face off with Adam Cole, Bobby Fish, and Kyle O'Reilly in a blood and guts match. And injuries prevented that from happening, but I also said that Omega would go babyface again in 2022, which he did. I predicted that Hook would take the TNT title from Cody Rhodes, and he may have, but we'll never know because Cody left before they could build to it. And I predicted that Jamie Hayter would soon split away from Britt Baker and challenge for the AEW Women's Championship at Revolution, but would lose because Britt would drop her title instead to Thunder Rosa, which she did, but she did it on Dynamite, not Double or Nothing like I thought she would. I predicted that Santana and Ortiz would finally win AEW Tag Team Gold, which not only did not happen, but now it looks very unlikely that it'll ever happen, which makes me sad. I predicted Jeff Hardy would make his AEW debut and reunite the Hardy Boys, which is what happened, and that the Briscoes would come to AEW for a match with FTR. And they did wrestle FTR 3 times, in fact, but it was technically for Ring of Honor and not AEW. I predicted this would finally be the year that Trios titles were introduced in AEW, so I was right about that. But I also thought that Brian Pillman Jr. and Chris Statlander would win the men's and women's Owen Hart Cup tournaments. Instead, they gave it to Adam Cole and Britt Baker. I predicted 2022 would be the year that AEW made its UK debut at Craven Cottage. and they will not be making it across the pond until later this year. I predicted several AEW talent contracts would expire and not be renewed, and that is exactly what happened with Joey Janela, Marco Stunt, Jack Evans, and Stu Grayson of the Dark Order. I thought Brian Cage would be one of them, and I was shocked that he wasn't. He was just as shocked when Tony Khan rolled over his options, so I wasn't the only one to get that wrong. I predicted that we would see Kazuchika Okada wrestle in AEW for the very first time, which he did at Forbidden Door, but that it would be against Bryan Danielson, which it was not. And finally, I predicted that Will Ospreay would win the G1 Climax. He did make it all the way to the finals, but he lost to Okada. So, like last year, or I guess 2021, a mixed bag. Some of them were on the nose, others were not even close. I will try to do better with my 2023 predictions for the wrestling world. I predict that WWE will get a massive rights increase for its programming from Comcast/NBC Universal. That will see all WWE shows airing on their networks in 2024 and beyond. That includes Raw and NXT on USA Network and SmackDown moving from Fox to NBC. And I do believe that having all of their content under the NBC Universal umbrella, including their agreement with Peacock, will eventually lead to them buying WWE, although them buying WWE outright will not happen next year. It will not happen this year. It will not happen next year, but I believe it will happen. And we've talked about this on the podcast many times. Potential suitors for WWE: Disney, Amazon, NBC Universal / Comcast, Fox. I mean, there's a lot of different corporate entities that could afford to buy, you know, or acquire WWE if they want to. NBC Universal, I mean, as much of a relationship as these two companies have, it just is the one that makes the most sense. I predict that Vince McMahon, while trying to disguise his identity, will attempt to crash the Raw 30th anniversary show in Philly later this month, but he will be denied entry into the building, much like Bobby Heenan trying to get into the Manhattan Center for that first Raw back in 93. I predict that Stone Cold Steve Austin will be a surprise entrant in this year's Royal Rumble match in Texas. At least he'll be a surprise until PW Insider or Fightful spoil it. But I kid. I like Mike and I like Sean. But that glass is going to shatter, and those people are going to go batshit crazy. He's not going to win, but it's going to set up whatever the match is that he'll be doing at WrestleMania. I predict that for all the waiting, will he, won't he, what's he going to do? I predict The Rock will not wrestle Roman Reigns at WrestleMania. I think The Rock ultimately is going to decide, I have a lot of things on my plate. Movie stuff, TV show stuff, right? Young Rock. XFL is launching in about a month and a half. And I think ultimately he will decide against it. But Cody Rhodes will return to win the Royal Rumble, and he will be the man to take down the Tribal Chief at WrestleMania 39. And then Seth Rollins will be the man who then takes the championship from Cody later on to avenge all of those losses to him last year. I predict that Sami Zayn will challenge Roman Reigns for the championship in Montreal at Elimination Chamber after being excommunicated from the Bloodline. He will fall short, but he will go on to team with Kevin Owens at WrestleMania to beat the Usos and become WWE Tag Team Champions together for the first time. I mean, I've only been saying this now for, what, 4 months? Now everybody is saying it. I was talking about this at least four months ago. It's the story that makes sense. I predict that Rhea Ripley will win the Women's Royal Rumble match and then beat Bianca Belair at WrestleMania to win the Raw Women's Championship. I predict that Sheamus will finally win the Intercontinental Championship in 2023. He will win it in Los Angeles at WrestleMania. It should be from Gunther. I can't say that for sure, since there's been talk of Gunther against Brock Lesnar. But I am convinced that they are saving a Sheamus IC title win for WrestleMania, and that is the right place to do it. I predict that Ronda Rousey will wrestle her final match for WWE in 2023. I predict that Sasha Banks meanwhile, will wrestle again for WWE in 2023, but she will also wrestle for Stardom, and she will also wrestle at least one match for AEW. This is going to be the year of Mercedes. We are going to see her everywhere this year, but maybe except Impact. But ultimately, WWE is going to offer her a ton of money, and she will end up back home again by the end of the year. I predict that Edge will wrestle his retirement match on a major show in Toronto, and his opponent will be Kevin Owens. I predict that Matt Riddle will not last the year, and he will be released by WWE because of all of his personal drama. I predict that Big E will be cleared to return to the ring from his broken neck. I predict that Mandy Rose will be back working for WWE sometime in the first half of this year, and Toxic Attraction as a trio will debut on the main roster. I predict that WWE will bring back King of the Ring, and they will debut a new Queen of the Ring tournament, not the Queen's Crown crap that they did last year or the year before. They will bring it back as its own pay-per-view. I don't know what they're going to call it. That's the whole thing. If they're going to do King of the Ring and Queen of the Ring matches, even if it's just the semis and the finals, in one night, then you can't call it King of the Ring, right? You got to come up with some other name that incorporates both. But I believe that they will be back as a pay-per-view to replace Hell in a Cell. And I predict that Gunther will become King and Bayley will become Queen. I predict that LA Knight will hold the Intercontinental or US title this year. I predict that the Street Profits will break up and Montez Ford will go heel as a singles act. I predict that Johnny Gargano and Tommaso Ciampa will reunite their DIY team on the main roster, and they will be WWE Tag Team Champions before this year is over. I predict that Pat McAfee will have a match with Corey Graves sometime this year on a WWE pay-per-view. I predict that we will see Chelsea Green and Matt Cardona back in WWE this year, and both of them will return as surprise entrants in their respective Royal Rumble matches. I predict that this is the year that Nick Aldis finally signs with WWE. And I predict, when it comes to the Hall of Fame, that Batista, William Regal, Lex Luger, Mickey James, and the great Muda will be among the names inducted into the WWE Hall of Fame. Batista was supposed to headline in 2020. He declined due to the pandemic. He wanted it to be in front of actual people. And then you have Muda, you know, with Muda retiring, I think it's part of the deal that Triple H and Nick Khan made to allow Nakamura to wrestle him this morning, that Muda would accept an invitation into the Hall of Fame. And then as far as a celebrity inductee, my vote, my prediction, goes to Andy Kaufman. So I think we're looking at a Hall of Fame class of Batista, who would headline because they're in Hollywood, Batista, William Regal, Lex Luger, Mickey James, the great Muda, and Andy Kaufman. And I think that's a hell of a Hall of Fame class. I predict that Bron Breakker, Carmelo Hayes with Trick Williams, Grayson Waller, Cameron Grimes, Pretty Deadly, Katana Chance, and Caden Carter will all get call-ups to the main roster this year. I predict that Tiffany Stratton will be the next NXT Women's Champion, taking the title from Roxanne Perez. On the AEW front, I predict that CM Punk and AEW will officially part ways, and Punk will not wrestle a match for either AEW or WWE in 2023. I predict that Kota Ibushi will wrestle in an AEW ring for the first time, but it will not be as a member of the New Japan roster anymore. He will be working as a free agent. I predict that MJF will not only sign a new long-term contract to stay with AEW if he hasn't already, he will start 2023 as the AEW World Champion, and he will end 2023 as the AEW World Champion, as they continue to play into the whole bidding war of 2024 story with the idea that he might leave and take the title with him to WWE. I think he'll be champion for the entire year. I predict that Adam Cole will return to the ring early in 2023, and he will take the TNT Championship from Darby Allin after Darby wins the title back from Samoa Joe this week on Dynamite. I predict that AEW and New Japan will partner to present its second Forbidden Door pay-per-view, which will be headlined by Kenny Omega taking on Kazuchika Okada, and that Stardom will be involved in this year's Forbidden Door show with the IWGP Women's Championship being defended. I predict that FTR and Andrade El Idolo will be out of AEW and back in WWE by year's end, although Dax and Cash will freelance for a while before signing a full-time deal. I predict that Jon Moxley will finally turn heel. I predict that Sting will wrestle his final match in 2023 in an AEW ring. It'll be alongside Darby Allin. And on the other side of the ring will be Chris Jericho and Sammy Guevara. You know, Sting and Jericho, they have never worked together. Not in WCW, not in WWE. And I'm shocked they haven't worked together yet in AEW. I think that changes this year. I predict that the House of Black will win the AEW Trios titles. I also predict that Chris Statlander will return to take the TBS championship from Jade Cargill, handing her her first defeat. I predict that Konosuke Takeshita will win the AEW All-Atlantic Championship. I predict that Ring of Honor will get its weekly show early in the year on its Honor Club service, and by the end of 2023, it will be streaming on YouTube, because Tony Khan will be unable to get a television deal for it. And finally, we tried this last year. It didn't happen. But I think this year, Will Ospreay will finally win the G1 Climax. And those are my predictions for the wrestling world in 2023. Do you agree? Do you disagree? What are your predictions? Drop me a tweet. Send me an email. Let me know what you think. But those are my predictions for the new year and beyond. If you have questions for the mailbag, you can email me, thesolomonster@gmail.com. The email address is the same in 2023 as it was for the previous 15 years. No reason it should be any different in year 16. Just include your name and where you are from. We're not going to do too much here, but we'll start with Curtis in Waterloo, Ontario, Canada. Is CM Punk versus Kenny Omega or FTR and Punk against the Elite the biggest matches that AEW could do? Or do you think there is a bigger match that AEW could promote? I mean, as the roster is right now, it would be Punk against Omega. No one is saying that that would not be a big match, but whatever business that it would do, would it be worth it to potentially blow up your locker room again just to make it happen? That's the question. There were a lot of Punk matches left on the table that they never did. Punk and Danielson again, for the first time in AEW, or a three-way with Punk and Danielson and Samoa Joe, right? Ring of Honor style. Punk and FTR against Omega and the Bucks, that would be a big one also. So yes, those probably are the biggest matches they could do, but you have to look at that and think, okay, what kind of business is this going to generate relative to the potential shitstorm and headaches that it would cause to get it done? Alberto from Laredo, Texas, would you ever see a wrestler or wrestlers honored at the White House, similar to how sports teams who win are honored? No. Why would they do that? Wrestlers don't win anything. It's all a work, bro. There's no reason for that. Unless there's some wrestler that, you know, saves a bunch of buildings from a burning orphan or something. There's no reason to have a wrestler honored at the White House. Peter from Greensboro. What a year that you've had. The amount of content you have put out is astounding. But how in the world are you able to continue without the issues of burnout? Sunday Sound Off, live Monday, live Wednesday, live Friday, plus pay-per-view coverage, predictions, special interest uploads, watch-alongs, HOG, all on top of having a full-time gig. How are you able to not burn out? And has there been a time that you wanted to or considered quitting? Well, first of all, this is an abbreviated version of his email, so thank you for the nice words. I'm glad that you enjoy all the content. I'm burned out all the time. It's not... Of course, it would be impossible not to be. I'm burned out all the time. I find a way to manage it. You know, I enjoy the work that I do. I enjoy doing it. I find time for it, you know, probably at the expense of a bunch of other stuff. But no, I mean, I'm constantly burned out. Are you kidding? I've been burned out for years. It's just a matter of how you manage it. You know, I would not advise people to do that and to burn, if that's how they feel, you know, to burn themselves out. But, you know, I find a way to make it work. It's a juggling act, but I find a way to make it work. Everybody seems to enjoy the content, so I'm going to keep doing it until I can't do it anymore. But thank you for the kind words. And finally, I want to read an email from Jamie in Waterloo. Actually, this might be the... how about that? I just realized, total coincidence, we had two people in the mailbag this week from Waterloo. Maybe they know each other. Curtis in Waterloo, Ontario, and now we have Jamie. But I want to thank Jamie again for his support on the New Year's Eve stream last night. He said it's okay to read this on the show, so I want to read this email from him. He says, I just wanted to thank you for getting back to me the day that my fiancé died last year. Day by day, every day does get easier over time, although the special days can be difficult. You were right that time makes things easier. I find being open about it helps a lot, just telling people my story and everything leading up to my fiancé's passing. Anyone listening that has experienced the loss of a loved one, I can't imagine how they feel, especially yourself, but my advice is to just talk about it when you can. Being open about it makes it easier every time. Don't keep it bottled up, as your mind will fuck with you. Share your memories of happier days and all the great things that you did with that person. Memories will always last forever. I don't get much time to listen to the podcast, but I try to support the show when I can. Keep up the hard work in 2023. If Reigns and Rock happens at WrestleMania 39, I just might have to buy a ticket. Well said, Jamie. I think that's some great advice. And we have a good community of people here. So anytime you want to pop onto one of the live streams and hang out, you know where to find us. And you know where to find me. Each and every Sunday, we're doing it this year like we did in 2022 and every other year. Each and every Sunday, next Sunday, is going to be episode 790. 790 of The Sound Off coming up next week. I'm sure coming out of Wrestle Kingdom and a big AEW show on Wednesday, there'll be plenty of news to talk about. So come on back here next Sunday. Follow me on Twitter, at Solomonster. Subscribe to the channel on YouTube and help me get to 72,000 subscribers. That is the next goal that we are slowly crawling toward. Frustratingly slowly, but we are slowly making our way to 72K. And that's all I got. It's been a busy weekend. We had a long night with the stream last night. If you missed it, I went live on New Year's Eve, third year in a row. We hung out. We did some prediction stuff. And hung out. From 1 year into the next. So if you want to go back and take a look at that, the video is up on the YouTube channel. Be well. Stay safe. Happy New Year again to each and every single one of you, wherever you may be in the world. And I will be back here with you again, as always, for 790 next Sunday. Until then, Happy New Year.
The Solomonsters Sounds Off.
We had Butch taking on Ludwig Kaiser. So Butch targeted the fingers of Kaiser. Kaiser rolled to the floor. Kaiser rolled. Oh, I just popped myself. Kaiser roll. I fucking love it. I'm going to take a drink for that. Sometimes it's the little things that amuse me the most. Oh, man. Kaiser rolled to the floor. I promise you, Sean, I was not. I didn't have that in my back pocket. I was not waiting for the rim shot. Sometimes these things just come together in a perfect way.
The Solomonster Sounds Off. Each week, bursting with content. Podcasts, predictions, reviews, YouTube live streams, and more. Become a channel member for perks and follow The Solomonster on Twitter at Solomonster.
Solomonster.
Solomonster. Solomonster Sounds Off.